Welcome to the show. Pleasure to be with you. Another Sunday night in Detroit, broadcasting into southeastern Michigan, southern Ontario, northern Ohio, via our huge signal, but around the world, around the country, via the internet. Welcome to everybody. Our phone number is 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-WRIF. Don't call in and tell me this, because I'm going to do this on my own, but I, after all these years, I'm going to figure out what WRIF is numerically. Because you hear that, people always, they'll say WRIF, and then they'll give it in numbers as well. Because I've had people say, why, I can't get it. Or they're in the dark. Or sometimes people are blind, too. So that's tough on them. If you'd like to email me during the show or any other time, calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. If you want any chance of having it read on the air, short, has to be short. If you want to do it longer, some people on issues like what we're seeing in the Middle East impels people to write at length. It's okay, but I certainly can't sort through it while I'm on the air. Okay. Oh, yeah. And this hour of Night Call is brought to you by Waking Up. It's Metro Detroit's sweatshop free clothing store. It's located in the Universal Mall. That's 12 Mile Road and the Quinder in Warren. You can visit their website at wakingupstore.com. Mike Kitchen, the proprietor, very supportive of this show. Go in there, say hello, tell them you heard it on this broadcast. Well, we're watching the destruction of Lebanon. This is not the first time, of course, it has occurred at the hands of Israel in 1982. It is so horrific what is going on there. It's so excessive beyond what actually Israel suffered that it just boggles the mind. Although, things are getting better all the time. And I say this very facetiously. The last time Israel invaded Lebanon, they killed 20,000 civilians. 20,000 civilians were killed. And, of course, we're here 24 years later, and not much has changed. If anything, Hezbollah and groups like that have gotten stronger and more heavily armed. As we talk, they are, of course, not invasions. They're incursions, if you see the mainstream news. But I saw this on CNN on their print edition. It says, against growing international criticism that Israel's response to Hezbollah's July 12th attack has been disproportionate, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations on Sunday defended Israel's use of force. Ambassador John Bolton said, I think it's important that we not fall into the trap of moral equivalency here. In other words, the actions of each side are the same. Because a lot of people are looking and saying, well, there they go again. Yeah, right. Crazy Israelis, crazy Arabs, which it does not do much of a service to understand what's going on. So Bolton says the standard explanation for all of this, what Hezbollah has done is kidnap Israeli soldiers and rain rockets and mortar shells on innocent Israeli civilians. What Israel has done in response is act in self-defense. I don't quite know, he says, what the argument about proportionate force means here. Is Israel entitled only to kidnap two Hezbollah operatives and fire a couple of rockets aimlessly into Lebanon? Well, they're certainly not aimless, the ones coming from Israel. All right, so we've heard that. It's on every newscast, and that is the premise, that it all started about, I got the dates a little later in the stuff I have here, about 8 or 10 days ago, because out of nowhere, Hezbollah kidnapped these people, and it's in par for the course. These people that want to destroy Israel, hate Israel, it's ongoing, and one can imagine that a sovereign nation wouldn't allow this to go on, and hence attacked, trying to destroy the base of operations. They seem to have limitless, Hezbollah seems to have limitless rockets. I mean, they're just tossing these in by the hundreds. There must be some limit to them, though. And there doesn't appear to be any limit on Israel's side, because the United States is rushing so-called precision bombs to Israel to make up for what they've used to destroy Lebanon. Now, here's what strikes me. So you've heard all this. You know the Bolton story. Every time you turn on the news, you've seen this story. You've read this explanation. You've been told that this is Israel's rationale, and on and on. Where's the other side? Remember, we've talked about this now over the years, about the necessity to examining every social, political, and in this case, military question from all sides. Now, you might, once learning the other side, dismiss it and think, I know it. But one of the things I often do as a debater's tactic is to say, tell me what I'm saying. And they always, people go, huh? Because they usually cannot repeat what the argument that you're making. And I mean, it sounds a little arrogant. Sorry, it's a weird verb. But I pride myself, if you will, on being able to repeat back. If someone said to me, I want you to give George Bush's explanation for why the United States is in Iraq, why it is successful, why it is important, why it was even necessary to do even if there were no weapons of mass destruction, I could begin talking and you would think you were listening to a right-wing Republican radio show. Because I know all of their arguments and it's important to do so. So why aren't the arguments against what Israel has done, against the whole situation there that goes back to the 1940s, why isn't that being given? It's not like there's not prominent people involved that could do this. Now, I got this off, and a lot of what I have here, this is the other side. Is from Israeli peace groups, too, because there's lots of them. There was just a demonstration in Tel Aviv, the capital of Israel, denouncing Israel's attack on Lebanon. Not on Hezbollah, but the fact that they are destroying the civilian infrastructure of Lebanon. They're killing hundreds of citizens that have nothing to do with Hezbollah, that are in some cases nowhere near Hezbollah's range of control, but are actually reducing life in that country so that all the amenities of modern society are gone. It's an attack on Lebanese civic society. And in fact, I actually don't have her name in front of me, the woman, the Canadian jurist who is head of the United Nations war crime. She said a war crime may be committed here. They're not attacking Hezbollah. There is some battles going on with them. But when you start destroying, well, let me get into this a little. Here is an Israeli, Yuri Avnery. It's Avnery. And on the website from Not In My Name, you can go to NIMN, notinmyname.org. And their heading is Seeking a Just Peace Between Israelis and Palestinians. Yuri Avnery talks about the real aim of Israel. Of course, we say, what do you mean the real aim? Their soldiers were kidnapped, not captured, right? But they were kidnapped, and they can't allow this rocketry to go on. Yuri Avnery, who is in a precarious position as any Israeli. Okay? So it's not like this is a sort of like a political opinion. All of the opinions of Israelis and of Lebanese and of Palestinians are matters of life and death. So here's what Yuri Avnery says. The real aim is to change the regime in Lebanon and to install a puppet government. The real aim of Israel is to change the regime in Lebanon and install a puppet government. It's a very long article. Just one more sentence from it. That was the aim of Ariel Sharon's invasion of Lebanon in 1982. It failed, but Sharon and his pupils in the military and political leadership have never really given up on it. And there's enough information on the web that should be as available as are the statements of George Bush and Ambassador Bolton, all the rest of them, John Bolton, as is this stuff. Why am I here to have to read this to you after I've searched assiduously through the internet? It's because it's propaganda. It's Pravda. It's Esvestia. Those are the two papers in the Soviet Union that only gave the official party line. It's partly out of contempt and arrogance that they're unwilling to give the general American population all sides of the question. But mainly they know, once people know both sides, they're not as quick to line up behind the official government position. In fact, if you think about the outsider position as opposed to the official position, throughout at least the 20th century and much of it going back into the 19th century as well, the official position of almost everything has been a lie, and the outsider's position has always proved to be the one that was actually the case, whether it's the Mexican-American War or the Spanish-American War, the First World War, Vietnam, a lot of things like that. The Iraq War. Remember the critics that said Bush was lying about weapons of mass destruction, that Bush was lying about connection with Al-Qaeda? And I've told this story before, how when I was doing a nationally syndicated show there, at that time, between 2000 and 2003. And I lost affiliate after affiliate after affiliate. Oh, he said there was no weapons of mass destruction. He sounds like an Al-Qaeda agent. Well, now it's common coin. The majority of people agree with what I was saying. But people accepted unquestionably the official position, the official statement. Before you make a decision that affects the lives and deaths of people or the destruction of a society, and you could turn that back, you know, to Israel as well. But right now, what the real damage, the overwhelming damage, is being done to Lebanon. There's damage being done to Israel, and people dying there as well. But learn, or say, hey, you know what? I'm not interested in this. I want to know how the tigers did. I want to have a picnic with my family. Okay, I don't think that's a way that people in democratic society should function, but at least don't come up with an opinion. When someone says to you, do you agree with the official position of why Israel is invading Lebanon and destroying the country? You say, you know what? I don't know all the sides. I'm too busy with my work and my family and enjoying myself and sports and 6,000 miles away, so I don't want to give an opinion. But don't line up unquestionably behind the official position. Think of those of you who, as a matter of, I don't know what, trying to be a good citizen or whatever, said, yes, George Bush said all about Iraq, for instance, and how the rug has been pulled out from under you. Well, that'll happen again and again and again. All right. So the real aim is to change the regime in Lebanon and to install a puppet government. And this is what the United States wants as well. It wants compliant client states in that region. Also, Israel wants to destroy, in fact, if they haven't done it already, the democratically elected government of Palestine, the Hamas government. What they want there is a colonial regime that'll act as colonial police to stop people that say, wait a minute, there was a theft of land here. Again, you can argue whether it was or wasn't, but the Palestinians feel that land was stolen from them. It's like all white settler states. We live in a white settler state. We took land, belonged to other people, established a nation state based on people of European ethnicity. Same thing happened in Canada. Same thing happened in South Africa. Same thing happened in Australia. We wanted a place where we could play golf and put out our lawn chairs. So the Cherokees and the Ottawas and the Mescalero Apaches and the Nez Perce and the rest of them be damned. You're not stopping us. We want this land, we're taking it. That's the way white settler states work. Well, if you're really smart and you're a white settler state, you kill all the inhabitants. So there was this genocide of enormous proportions, perhaps 30 million people that were here, and you claim that they were savages and they never had anything approaching a society worthwhile. And suddenly, the whole history of the region, with except for a few footnotes, is all about the white settlers, including the settler ancestors, many of us listening, maybe even most of us. Now, in Africa, in South Africa, that really came up and bit them in the butt, because not only did they not get rid of the indigenous people that they stole the land from, that finally they couldn't control them, and the white settlers were essentially thrown out. So there still is a contest in Israel-Palestine about the land that was appropriated by these white settlers who came from Europe. Whatever the character, whatever the racial character is of it today, that was its initial origins. And I'll tell you, people that get their land stolen, I get pretty pissed off, as you would be. And they do the damnedest things. Here in the United States, they began killing women and children, the savages. They were called savages by the settlers, who said, wait, man, all we're doing is putting up our wagon, bringing our wagon trains across here and taking all the land, of course. They began doing the most outrageous thing. Well, that happens. That's par for the course. And I was at that big demonstration in Dearborn last Tuesday, where 10,000 people cried out in horror of what's happening to Lebanon. Not to Hezbollah, but to innocent people in Lebanon, to the infrastructure of Lebanon that was built up, rebuilt after so many years, and just targeted. Let me tell you, let me just get into this a little. Remember I was saying, what's necessary here to provide is both sides of the story. What we have when John Bolton talks, when George Bush talks, when Condoleezza Rice talks, I mean, you know, all this destruction and death is going on, Condoleezza Rice says, well, maybe I'll get over there. on Monday or so. Maybe I'll talk to the Israelis. Meantime, all right. So there are prominent people. Pardon me. Here is Ralph Nader, who most of us don't know is of Lebanese extraction. He wrote a letter to George Bush, and this is his letter. So this should be news, but how many of you saw this? Why did I have to go to these extreme lengths to even find a statement of somebody of prominence within the United States who does not have sympathy with terror or terrorists to make a statement that challenges the official U.S. and Israeli position on all of this? Here's what Ralph Nader says in his letter to George W. Bush. With systematic efficiency, the Israeli government has already destroyed innocent homes and basic public facilities, ports, airports, highways, bridges, power stations, which are critical to the delivery of food, medicines, health care, ambulances, water, and other essentials for a civilian population. This bombardment by U.S.-made bombers, military vehicles, ships, and missiles with American taxpayer subsidies places an inescapable responsibility upon your shoulders, on Bush's shoulders, which does not mix with your usual vacuous messianic rigidity. He's pissed, you can tell that. Ralph Nader continues, as the leading player in the official Washington puppet show, it is time for you to assert the interests of the American people and those of the broad Israeli and Palestinian peace movements by standing up to the puppeteers, for without this conflict, Hezbollah would not be in today's news. Former U.S. Senator from South Dakota and a Lebanese-American, James Aberesk, says, I can understand the concern about soldiers being captured, but why is there no concern about the Lebanese civilians who have been kidnapped by the Israeli army in southern Lebanon and held in Israeli prisons? One of the things that Hezbollah did, they're not just these crazy Arabs. They had plans. This really backfired on them, though, because they did not know that Israel, with the complicity of the United States, had planned this destruction of the Lebanese government and the destruction of Gaza and Hamas way in advance of any of this occurring. They're waiting for the trigger point. Trigger point was that Hezbollah came into Israel. Now, Israel has kidnapped any number of Lebanese, and they're held without trial in Israel. And Hezbollah said, oh, we are going to negotiate a deal. You give us back our prisoners, and maybe, by the way, you should get out of more Lebanese territory as well, which you still occupy, as opposed to every UN resolution. Now, they say, well, you know, Hezbollah is supposed to disarm. Israel has a history of refusing to follow the most number of directions from the United Nations of any country in the world. In fact, all the countries combined. And there'd be more of them if the United States didn't veto resolutions routinely that direct Israel to bring peace and justice to the Palestinians. And Senator Aberesk says, if Israel is so bent on retaliating, why do they not confront Hezbollah directly instead of destroying grain silos in Tripoli, Lebanon? Ambulances coming from the United Arab Emirates, fuel supplies and power plants that provide electricity and water to the citizens of Lebanon. When Israel bombed the power plant in Gaza, Senator Aberesk says, I believe they did so in order to once again attempt to sell power to the Palestinians, which they did until Palestine built its own power plant. This is an effort to hold both Lebanon and the Palestinians hostage. If you're an American taxpayer, you're paying for the destruction of Lebanon. And this. Front page of the New York Times. U.S. speeds up bomb delivery for the Israelis. Don't want them to run out, right? The Bush administration is rushing a delivery of precision-guided bombs to Israel, which requested the expedited shipment last week. The decision to quickly ship the weapons to Israel was made with relatively little debate within the Bush administration. Its disclosure threatens to anger Arab governments and others, do you think? Because of the appearance that the United States is actively aiding the Israeli bombing campaign. Do you think? You know, that could be compared to Iran's efforts to arm and resupply Hezbollah. And what Iran is doing, if in fact they are, and they very well may be, they got weapons from somewhere, it pales before the United States armament with our tax dollars of Israel. The munitions that the United States is sending to Israel are part of a multi-million dollar arms sale package approved last year that Israel is able to draw on as needed. We send them money, you and me, out of our paycheck. Rather than sending it here to fix our stuff, we send it to Israel, and then they buy armaments from Bush's buddies and Bush's father's company, the Carlyle Group. But, all right, what are the consequences of this? Well, a lot of people, you know, Lebanon, they've always been fighting, you know, we care. Here's why I care among, well, this isn't why I care, actually. This is number one. This is number, like, reason 37. Number one, it's, you know, it's a horrible crime. Across the Middle East, sermons critical of the U.S. in mosques from Mecca to Marrakesh. Sermons at Friday prayer services underscored both the David versus Goliath glamour many Arabs associated with Hezbollah's fight against Israel and their antipathy, read hatred, towards the United States and its allies in the region. Sheikh Hazza el-Maswari said, "Our brothers are being killed in Lebanon and no one's responding to the cry for help." Where's the thing that really did it? Oh, yeah. Mustafa Hamarek, director of the Center for Strategic Studies at the University of Jordan, says, "What is creating radicalism in the region is not authoritarian regimes. Mainly, it is American policy in the region. Survey after survey shows that." So it is American policy in the region which creates radicalism, not authoritarian regimes. Which means essentially, we're paying to create people that do the stuff that was done to us on September 11th. This is payback, they see, for what we're financing in the Middle East. Let's see. This is, where is this from? I don't know where the hell this is from. ZNet. That's good. ZNet.org, I believe. Maybe .com. After Hamas. Now, Hamas, they're, oh, these are terrible people, too, because they were involved in armed struggle against the government of Israel until they got elected. Now, it depends on what side you're on. My a distant relative of mine, Light Horse Harry Lee, that's what my great aunt told me, who was a relative of Robert E. Lee, but took part in guerrilla warfare against the British. Boy, they thought he was a terrorist. After Hamas's election, it says, Israel and the United States spearheaded the imposition of severe economic... pardon me. Man, this stuff has not gone away. The cold's gone, but the stuff remains. After Hamas's election, I remember this was this group, Hamas, that besides having an armed wing, also provided all these social services that are so lacking in Palestine because of the domination of the of the occupation by Israel in such terrible conditions that they impose on them. After Hamas's election, Israel and the United States spearheaded the imposition of severe economic sanctions against the Palestinians that have virtually crippled their infrastructure. Now, we've got problems here in Michigan, but think about having our infrastructure crippled. Israel, which continues to control Gaza's economy, withholds about $50 million of Palestinian monthly tax revenues. When Palestinians in Gaza captured an Israeli soldiers and members of Hezbollah in Lebanon captured two Israeli soldiers, Israel unleashed massive armed attacks against the people of Gaza and Lebanon. Although justified as necessary to free the captured soldiers, Israel really hopes to destroy Hamas and Hezbollah in the process. So what Israel's goal is in the territories that they illegally occupy, and they virtually, even though they don't have troops there anymore, they occupy Gaza, they occupy the West Bank. They wanted, even though this was a democratic election, they don't like the outcome. And ZNet continues, The Israel military demolished hospitals, airports, highways, power stations, fuel depots, and entire buildings with their inhabitants in Lebanon and Gaza. This is happening in Palestine. They are targeting hospitals. They are targeting airports. They are targeting power stations. Hundreds of innocents have been killed and thousands injured. Israel kidnapped dozens of Hamas leaders. All right, you know, this could go on forever. The question is, I mean, you could call them and say, I don't agree with any of it. Israel has every right in the world to do it. Why haven't you heard any of this? Why haven't you been given both sides of this? What is the fear of the people that control the information that the only way that you can get this is go digging through the internet? Why isn't this sidebarred, or why isn't this given equal space on every single newscast? Why isn't there someone up there on every cable news show giving this side of it? Now, Alexander Coburn, which looks like something you get. Never mind. I don't know. This is a terrible joke. Never mind. This is too serious a subject to bring that up. Alex's last name is spelled C-O-C-K-B-U-R-N. C-O-C-K-B-U-R-N. But it's pronounced, fortunately for him, Coburn. He says, memory is supposed to stop in its tracks at June 28th, 2006. Let's go on a brief excursion into prehistory. He says, I'm talking about June 20th, 2006, when Israeli aircraft fired at least one missile at a car in an attempted assassination on a road between Jabalia and Gaza City. The missile missed the car. Instead, it killed three Palestinian children and wounded 15. Back we go again to June 13th. Israeli aircraft fired missiles at a van in another attempted assassination. The successive barrages killed nine innocent Palestinians. Now we're really in the dark ages, Alexander Coburn says, reaching far, far back to June 9th when Israel shelled a beach in Bet Lahia, killing eight civilians and injuring 32. He says, that's just a brief trip down memory lane, and we trip over the bodies of 20 dead and 47 wounded, all of them Palestinians, most of them women and children. Okay? This is what begins this. And every Israeli knows, and you can even read it in papers, daily papers from Israel like Haaretz, that talks about when the Israel routinely breaks the ceasefires. Whoa, did he just say the opposite of what we're always told? Israel routinely breaks the ceasefires, that they then know that there's going to be a suicide bombing in retaliation. They're just waiting for it, which is what the Israeli military attempts to create, is a constant state of warfare to justify the policies that they're carrying out. Eventually, I suppose they hope, just to complete ethnic cleansing and get rid of the Palestinians who finally say, you know, I can't take this anymore. Many, many Israelis are critical. As I said, there was a demonstration of thousands in Tel Aviv saying no to the war against Lebanon. Some of them are really critical. Michel Warchowski, in his 2004 book, Towards an Open Tomb, The Crisis of Israeli Society, he says, of his own country, this society no longer recognizes any boundaries, geographical or moral. He says, Israel knows no limits and is lashing out as it finds that its attempt to beat the Palestinians into submission and swallow Palestine whole is being thwarted by a resilient, dignified Palestinian people who refuse to submit quietly and give up resisting Israel's arrogance. Now, again, you could say 100%, I don't buy any of this, I support Israel 100%. The question is, why haven't you heard this anywhere except on this program? All right. Your comments are welcome. Oh, yeah. This is one article from a few days ago. 1,000 Americans flee Lebanon on ship. That's kind of like Katrina in the Mediterranean. Katrina in the Mediterranean, isn't it? And, well, let's do that. Let's just take a break, get you a chance to call. 313-298-WRIF. I'm Peter Werby. This is Night Call. Right back.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Greater Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are not transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, One Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
We'll be right back. Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back to this segment. I'd like to hear from you. 313-298-WRIF. Email calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Hey, go to my website if you want to read some of these articles that I've been quoting from, plus some others. It's the other side of the issue of what's going on now in the Middle East, and it's not provided on the regular news. So you can read the regular news, you can watch the cable. Why you do all that is beyond me, but whatever. They seem like a useless source, although the visuals are pretty shocking, aren't they? Anyway, my website is peterwerby.com, P-E-T-E-R-W-E-R-B-E.com. And oh yeah, gas prices, that's another little result of this all. Gas prices now hit an all-time high. Up to, what is it, just over $3 per gallon. It's higher here in Michigan, isn't it? And listening on the internet is Dan in Alabama. He writes, because Ralph Nader wrote a letter to George Bush telling him to stop this attack on Lebanon, make Israel stop. Isn't it interesting that we play such a role over there? Why is that? We wouldn't let any country play a role over here. Anyways, he says, write letters to George Bush. They will make no difference because George Bush cares as much about the Lebanese people as he does about the Iraqi people, the Afghan people, or the American people. Let's go to our first call. It's Debbie in Bellevue. Debbie, it's Peter Werby, and you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Hopefully you let me finish my talk. Actually, this is the first time that I've actually listened to you. And me and my husband, who's a Marine who's on active duty, he's sitting here. And, you know, actually I wrote down some notes, and, you know, he's like, you know, how do we feel sorry for people that are raping and killing their own people?
Wait a minute, who's raping and killing their own people?
The Lebanese.
You know, this is, why would you make a statement like that? How are they raping and killing
there.
Their own people?
He was there.
Well, they're not raping their own killing. You know who's raping and killing their own people are Americans. There's people raping and killing in Phoenix. There's people, snipers, shooting people on the Indiana toll roads. Would you say then that the Americans are raping and killing our own people?
Can I finish?
Well, no, not necessarily. Answer my question. Why would you make that kind of slur on the Lebanese people?
Well, I make that kind of slur on the Lebanese people is because that's the kind of culture they are.
That's, you know what? This is one of the most murderous cultures in the world. We have the highest murder rate of any industrialized country. We have the highest crime rate of any industrialized country. And anyways, you know, to have that, you know, the culture that you talk about is so complex. It's so tied in with the political domination of imperial powers from, you know, beginning in the 19th century. That to make these aspersions on a whole people. Do you know Lebanese people?
Yes, I do.
Well, do they seem murderous to you?
My local party store, I do.
Oh, God, you're out of here, local party store. Man, you know. All right. Here's Mike in Dearborn. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Peter. How you doing?
You're on the air.
First-time caller.
Welcome.
And, you know, never very political as I start getting older, but I'm not a Bush supporter. But today on the news I saw that the Arab Lebanese Federation, or whatever you want to call it, is filing a lawsuit against the federal government for not helping soon enough and letting their people die. Well, you know, I'm not a Bush supporter, but sometimes you have to throw a dog a bone. I mean, come on. If I own a house and I let my best buddy run a dope house out of the basement and they bust me, well, I'm going to jail too. Okay, I may be innocent, but I'm going. Well, Lebanese people let Hezbollah run their terrorist organization through Lebanon, and unfortunately some, you know, civilians, you know, people that should not be dying are dying, but...
if you want to make an omelet, you got to break a few eggs, right?
But, right, but yeah, right. Through the federal government. Now, I mean, today I was driving through Dearborn, and I have a problem. I have Arabs live around me. I have no problem. But, you know, they're walking around in their garb and stuff, fine and dandy. That's their culture. That's their religion. But yet... You send a young lady to Lebanon or any Arab country and say she's in a halter and a short skirt, I believe she's going to be put off the street and put in jail.
Well, not in Lebanon, certainly. I mean, make sure you your statements are precise. I mean, there's, you know, and the countries that are the most strict, by the way, are the ones that are being financed by our dollars, like Saudi Arabia.
I remember in the first war, the army people would talk. They couldn't have any type of magazine showing woman flesh. They couldn't have.
Well, whatever. What does that have to do with destroying Lebanon?
You know, I mean, they should be. To sue the federal government because we didn't help enough. Well, your house is burning. You're not just going to run into it.
You know, there's a whole lot of reasons, including why Hezbollah continues to function in southern Lebanon. One of them is there's that the central government there does not have the power, the ability to confront them. They went through this civil war of which thousands of people were killed. Israel invaded and killed 20,000 people. The country was wrecked by the mid-1980s, and it's been 20 years where they have rebuilt this into essentially a secular society, because there's half the Lebanese are Christian, and there's other little groups as there are in these artificially cobbled together countries, and they've gotten along. The reason that Hezbollah exists is because of the failure of Israel to come to grips in a just manner with the Palestinian people there. They've refused to exit from Lebanese-controlled territory, and they've. And I'm not saying that gives people the right to begin shelling civilians. It doesn't. But when I was in Dearborn, your city, for that demonstration on Tuesday, there was a young man that held almost a kid held a sign that said, "No justice, no peace." And that's the way it comes down, whether we like it or not. And if you're not going to provide justice with people, there's no telling what the hell they will do. Thanks, Mike. All right, here is Sam in Dearborn. Sam, hi. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Doing good. Thanks for calling in.
Peter, first of all, I'd like, me and everybody who believes in justice for all would like to commend you on letting the truth be told today, and we appreciate it very much.
Well, if anything, it's like I said, I don't even know why I'm arguing to some extent. The only thing I'm saying is if before people can make decisions, they've got to know all sides of it. What we've essentially gotten, just like we live in the Soviet Union and we're reading Pravda, is one side of it.
That's exactly what my next comment was. When you lived, when they spoke of the Soviet Union as the government-controlled media, now you're facing the same thing in the United States by Israeli-supported media controllers. And it's the way I see it, and that's why I don't see any second sides to any stories here. And most of these people that watch the news and as your callers call in, they're getting all their information and their counterattacks or debates that they have based on what they're learning from the media, which is essentially controlled by Israeli supporters.
Yeah, it's, that's the official line. And I don't even know. It's kind of hard to figure out how most Americans look at this. I suspect, unfortunately, they're not energized by the question. I think people that have an ethnic connection to it, either in this area, and a large number of people from the Middle East or Middle Eastern ancestry, and also the Jewish community. I think people that whose ethnicity doesn't go back there again probably buys the whole idea they're all crazy. Right. And probably given that the exotic manner in which Arabs are presented, probably think the Arabs are the most crazy. Right.
I agree.
Yeah. And as well, it's like I said, if you don't know all parts of it, since it's a matter of life and death, maybe you just ought to say, I don't know anything about it.
If you were to look at what America stood for and what America was when America was created and what it has gone through its history before the 50s, let's not talk about after the 50s, but before the 50s, what it stood for was everything that was right and everything that was justice, and they fought for that. And if the American people knew the truth today, I believe America would be a completely different place to live in.
Maybe so. All right, Sam, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. 313-298-WRIF. Let's go to Tony. Tony is up next. Where are you calling from, Tony?
Hi, I call from Lincoln Park.
Okay, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, I just, it turns out to be, again, that America's a bad guy. But, hey, finish. I'm not saying that support the Israelis or, to me, it just seems like, it's going to all boil down to money, land, and later on in life, we're all going to look back on this whole thing and be like, you know, what was that for?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we all, paying our tax dollars for the weapons and people out there, USA pays for most of weapons that are being used to destroy other countries. Hate to tell you that, but I have friends who are in the military, been there for 20, 30 years or longer, and they've all seen it. They've seen things being done over there, places and everything's.
And we're picking up the bill.
Exactly.
Yeah, but we got a lot of money left over. Everything's working fine here in the U.S., right? Jobs for everybody, infrastructure's good. I guess not.
I mean, homeless people could use that money. We could use it for better schools, better education. We could use it for I got an idea, maybe the economy.
Yeah, how about
jobs.
This too, Tony? How about a national health program so we could deliver the kind of health services to everyone that every other industrial country in the world has? Well, that just got blown down the drain with Bush's lying war against Iraq that is going worse and worse and worse every single day. People are going to begin to wish Saddam Hussein, if they don't already, is back, because this is hell that we have given them. Tony, thanks. Appreciate it. 313-298-WRIF. In fact, now, Iraq's Parliament Speaker, Mahmoud Mashhadani, bitterly criticized U.S. forces in Iraq, accusing them of butchery and demanding that they pull out of the country. This is the elected head of the parliament of Iraq, our little puppet government, which is not acting the way it's supposed to. But here is the parliamentary speaker, Mahmoud Mashhadani, saying, get out of the country. So why is the United States in there killing people and having our troops killed? I don't get this. I don't get this at all. 313-298-WRIF. Maybe you get it. Here's Mo in Dearborn Heights. Mo, hey, Peter Werby with you. Go ahead.
Peter, how you doing?
Doing good. Thanks for calling.
No, there's so much flowing through my mind. First of all, I am an American Arab. And to listen to some people talk, it's really, you know, I don't think anybody dislikes Americans. It's the American policy that's been the problem here. It's been the root problem for over 50 years. And we constantly hear the terms UN Resolution 1559. The problem with UN Resolution 1559 is it comes after 16 other UN resolutions that have been violated by Israel.
Remind people what 1559 is.
It's the disarmament of Hezbollah.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, let's not forget, they were armed due to the fact, as Ehud Barak, the former prime minister of Israel, says, we created Hezbollah. Israel created Hezbollah due to the fact that they invaded a sovereign nation in 1982 to weed out the Palestinians. They are the creator of Hezbollah. Now, prior to that, there are UN resolutions that call for Israel to give back all the land that they took after the 1967 war.
Yeah, I said earlier, Mo, that Israel has violated more UN resolutions than every country in the United Nations combined.
And they keep calling for UN Resolution 1559.
Yeah, well, they want that one enforced.
Of course, yeah. The one, you know, the one issue that I would most like to tell my fellow Americans is, you know, all human beings have the right to peace, and all human beings should have the right for justice. I heard one of your callers earlier, Debbie, saying her husband was in the Marines and he was in Lebanon. Therefore, I guess he has become an expert on Lebanon. There are no rapists, and if there are, they're criminals like they are here.
Yeah.
You know, it's one. I'll leave you with one last thing. Earlier
sure.
this evening, I heard Tom Friedman. I'm sure you know Tom Friedman.
Sure, with the New York Times, yeah.
You know, obviously, he had his little pro-Israeli thing going, but he said one thing that really sparked me, and he said that the Bush administration has been good at one thing. They have been good at destruction. They have not fixed anything in the last 6 years. They have been great at destruction throughout the world. They have not resolved one issue since they took over. The neocons, these hawks, have not fixed one issue. They've only destroyed the world.
Yeah, they are experts at breaking things. Actually, this is the rise of the neocons again. The neocons essentially had their policies are in shambles. And it was they against the oil companies, and because one of the reasons that they had planned for so long to invade Iraq was to control oil resources there and give American industry cheap oil. Well, obviously the oil companies don't want that, and who's won out? Thank you, Mo. Appreciate it. Thanks for calling in. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Let's go to Ann Arbor and talk to Jessica. Hey, Jessica. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks, Peter. I just wanted to be one more caller to say thank you so much for bringing up this issue. It's so easy just to turn on the news and you think CNN, you know, it's not as biased as Fox. You think, you know, you're getting the story, the truth. And, you know, it has truths, but it takes a lot of time out of everybody's, you know, busy lives to just, you know, seek out the real truth and, you know, go on to your online sources that you were mentioning and really try to find out, open your minds and try to really look at the picture.
Hey, Jessica, you know what? I mean, I appreciate appreciating my efforts, but why should I even have to be here? I've made that point all throughout the last 50 minutes or so. Why should I have had to assemble and accumulate all these ideas contrary to the position of the United States government, the Bush government, and Israel? These should be available and accessible and right up front with the other views so that each of us can make a decision. Yet it comes down to the point where people will say, oh, you're being courageous, or you're being, you know, thank you for presenting this point of view. It's damning. It's damning of the mainstream corporate news outlets that everything that I've said isn't known already. And that should be that as soon as I start saying that, people go, why is he saying that? I saw that 3 days ago. I heard that a week ago. I saw Ralph Nader condemning the invasion of Lebanon right after George Bush spoke, because they put that on as a counter. Because there are two opinions here. I put that on, that it was put on there as a counter to the other explanations. Instead, it becomes left to me at this one day a week on late Sunday night to give the other side. That really is terrible.
Yeah, and it's in conversations all around, you know, especially campus university areas. People are discussing these things, but, you know, you look at probably the South, the southern part of the United States, and that's where there's a lot of people that just want to say that all the Arabs are terrorists. I mean, they would shriek at the fact that somebody actually thinks that the Israelis are performing terrorist acts.
Yeah, I'm so tired of dumb people that it is, maybe I've been doing this till it's actually beginning to wear me down a bit, but there's some Latin phrase. Someone can either, well, don't write it because I won't be able to pronounce it, but call in and say there's this phrase in Latin which is says essentially, don't let the bastards grind you down. I'll try. Thanks, Jessica. Thanks for your call. 313-298-WRIF. I'm Peter Werby, and let's take our next caller. It's Todd from Sterling Heights. Todd, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing good.
You guys are doing a great job, man. You're telling all the different sides. There's a big net over the U.S. where you only hear what they want you to hear.
You got it.
And I talk to my brother all the time, and he says, oh, Bush this, Bush that. I'm like, hey, Bush never did anything good, and he failed at everything he ever did.
Yeah, but they've all ruined everything. Even some of these guys you don't even hear about too much, like Dick Cheney. They've given all of the stuff away to his company, Halliburton. But when he ran Halliburton before he was the vice president, he made all these business decisions that turned out to just be terrible. They're not very smart, but they're so rich, they're so powerful, they're so wired in. So rather than a meritocracy, where people are judged on how well they do, it's the elite. How much are you, how much juice do you got? And these guys got the juice, and no matter how many mistakes they make, no matter how many people get killed, no matter how many people's lives they ruin, they're still at the country club, aren't they?
Hey, I'll forget about the propaganda from Karl Rove. The guy's wrapping his house in plastic and duct tape.
You know? Well, there you go. Let me get one more call before my break. Thanks. Here's Mohammed from Detroit, who was an ex-Army Ranger. Mohammed, welcome to the broadcast.
How you doing, Peter? Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
First and foremost, man, I love you. First-time listener and first-time caller, you got everything right on the bat. There's a couple of things I just wanted to say to little Miss Debbie over there.
Sure.
I don't know if she knows this or not, but in Lebanon, rape is covered by the death penalty. No going to psychiatrics, no going into this. We love our women so much, it's the death penalty, which it should be in many other places. Second thing.
I don't agree with that, but go ahead. Go ahead.
You know, you got the right to do that. But for the Hizb, people got to remember, they were the only ones fighting for Lebanon when Israel invaded. We had a civil war. Israel invades, and then the Hizb fought them back. That's the hearts and the sympathies of the Lebanese people. And one thing I want to ask, why isn't the media like old-time media, like Walter Cronkite, where he would question everything? Today's media isn't anything like that. You, thank God, are. You put the information out there, and you make people see both sides of the story. How come people aren't like that anymore?
Well, I think the corporations run everything. You either have a populist government where the rights and power of the people are accentuated, or you have a corporate government where the power of the corporation over the people is what determines political life and economic life, and that's what we have now. You know, I'd like to talk to you more. I got to get these spots in before midnight. Mohammed, thank you so much for your opinions, and I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Peter.
All right, we'll be right back.
Here's the best rock the Motor City has to offer. Before they hit it big, Motor City Riff. Every Sunday night at 10. It's loud. It's local. No friggin' satellite can give you the best local band. Like the station that supports local rock. 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks. Rock, rock, rock.
This is WRIF.com.
Home in the valley, home in the water from my hair. Continues as it can carry. Just took my son to a trip to me. You can't run it over again.
With more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back to our second hour at 1 a.m. Eastern Time. And I say that because people are listening all around the country and all around the world on the Internet. I'll have two interesting interviews, and my brain will start to click in. So these are all digital files now, not really named. So I'll remember in a second what they are. Marshall is listening in Yonkers, New York, and he wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Man, that rock music in between to fill the commercial gaps is rough. Sunday night after 11 p.m. and it's Black Sabbath or something. Ouch! I like Black Sabbath. War Pigs and all the Aussie stuff. Do you have any control over the music played during the breaks on the live stream? Now, and that's done a lot of things to do with my union, the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, because if this, if these ads go out over another medium and catch another audience like that, there'd have to be more payment to us announcers. So, if you're getting streamed, you usually have to hear some irritating music, but I will pass that on. Let's see here. I wanted to another one from Kim, who's listening in Dearborn Heights, said, I can't listen to these ignorant racist Americans much longer. Now, I should set that up. Debbie was our first caller up around noon, and she said that her husband was a Marine and had just been in Lebanon. Now, all of a sudden, I started thinking, what do you mean there are no Marines in Lebanon? They haven't been any Marines in Lebanon. They're helping with the evacuations now, but they're not there in the sense that we usually think of that. Unless somebody knows something I don't, they haven't been there since, when was it, 84, when that other horrid president, Ronald Reagan, placed all of those Marines in jeopardy and wound up getting hundreds of them killed? Anyways, so Debbie was saying that they have this culture of rape and murder, and I asked, did she know any Lebanese? And she, Lebanese. And she said, well, the guy at the party store. Yeah, those people are really repulsive. So I agree with you, Kim. It's hard to listen. She says, I can't listen to these ignorant racist Americans much longer. Well, the only thing I would take issue with you, that hasn't been entirely the nature of this. So we ought to, you know, if the shoe fits, put it on them. Tell them to come and talk to my Lebanese neighbors who are far better read and educated than most of the people in this country. My neighbor and I often lament the ignorance in this country, a country she loves but cannot understand when it comes to our ethnocentrism and lack of political sophistication. The door to peace in the Middle East is justice for the Palestinians. Thanks for going where others in the media dare not go. And that's so striking. Again, Kim from Dearborn Heights has simply thanked me for doing what every media outlet in America should be doing. That is giving all sides of this question instead of just one, the official one. Let's see, on July 20th, the House of Representatives passed House Resolution 921 by a vote of 410-8, and that was the House of Representatives reaffirms its steadfast support for the State of Israel. Seven paragraphs later, the representatives of the American people declare to the world that the United States, this is from James in Kenosha, Wisconsin, by the way, quote, supports Israel's right to take appropriate action to defend itself, including to conduct operations both in Israel and in the territory of nations which pose a threat to it, which is in accordance with the international law, including Article 51 of the United Nations Charter. This borders on the surreal, he says, a resolution of carte blanche support for future Israeli military action anywhere at any time. And what does the caveat accordance with international law mean in light of the Israel's occupation of Gaza and the West Bank? Three of the dissenting votes were cast by Dingell, Conyers, and Kilpatrick. Hey, you know what? My hat's off to John Dingell. Dingell represents Dearborn area, and hence has a lot of people of Middle Eastern, Middle Eastern background. And though usually the Democratic Party does not want to offend the supporters of Israel and the Israel lobby, John Conyers and also Carolyn Cheeks Kilpatrick, plus I believe five or quite a few other of the eight, quite a few of men of Lebanese extraction. So eight people in the entire Congress willing to, you know, to stand up to this bulldozer, right? All right, one of the things I wanted to talk about, too, and we can get back to the whole question of what's happening in the Middle East. You know, what do these Republicans do? Do they ever try to pass any legislation that helps American people rather than just dithering around with these resolutions? Here's the latest law they passed. The House, citing the nation's religious origins, which is a crock. The United States does not have religion at all. First Amendment. I always run this by people. First Amendment to the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, guarantees what right? People go, free speech, free press, freedom to assemble. It guarantees no right whatsoever. What it says is Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. That was the number one concern of the founding fathers when they looked at what were the impediments to democratic administration of life. It wasn't that we had the right of speech. It was that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. So these guys are morons and liars, these Republicans. Anyway, let me read the article. The House, citing the nation's religious origins, voted Wednesday to protect the Pledge of Allegiance from federal judges who might try to stop school children and others from reciting the pledge because of the phrase, under God. That was stuck in there in the mid-50s, so no one would confuse us with the godless communists, right? Because they were beating down our door. The legislation, a priority of social conservatives. Every goddamn problem in the world, I said that kind of advisedly, sorry if I offended anybody, is facing this country, and this is a priority of social conservatives. These people are in such la-la, well, you know what, they're not in la-la land. They're in our world. And, you know, they can do whatever they want. They can go pray to whatever, you know, invisible man. But can they please get out of our life with stuff like stem cell research? This goes to the Senate now. And it was 260 to 167, so some lame-ball Democrats voted for it as well. Now, Representative Zach Wamp, wow, that's my next name if I get reborn, Zach Wamp, said we should not and cannot rewrite history and to ignore our spiritual heritage. It surrounds us. It cries out for our country to honor God. Now, this guy must be reading some other document other than what I'm looking at. Now, let me just, sorry to keep, you know, beating this, but Zach Wamp says we should not and cannot rewrite history to ignore our spiritual heritage. It surrounds us. It cries out for our country to honor God. The First Amendment to the Constitution, the first clause, absolutely 100% denies that. Congress will make no law respecting the establishment of religion. But let's even go back to the pledge itself. You know who wrote the pledge? If you listen to the show, you know, you'll remember who. It was a socialist. That's right. A socialist wrote the Pledge of Allegiance. Christian socialist, a Baptist minister by the name of Francis Bellamy. And here is a recent, he's also a Freemason. Wow. Here's a report from, what's the newspaper here? The Commercial Appeal, that's the name of the paper, in Memphis. Descendants of the man who authored the Pledge of Allegiance say he wouldn't, he probably wouldn't mind the removal of the words under God because he wouldn't have wanted them added in the first place. Scott Bellamy, who owns a sandwich shop in a Memphis suburb, says his great-grandfather, Francis Bellamy, a socialist editor and Baptist minister, had a clear vision behind every word of the original pledge he wrote in 1892. Francis Bellamy protested even the addition of the phrase the United States of America on Flag Day in 1924, believing the pledge as he wrote it did not need changing. If he didn't want the United States of America in the pledge, he wouldn't have wanted under God, Scott Bellamy said. Now, here's the way it began. Remember, we said, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America. What he said, I pledge allegiance to my flag. Maybe it's splitting hairs, but everything these guys say is wrong. One of the things that you can do if people say, how can I figure out what's right and what's wrong? If these guys are talking, it's a lie. That's the best way to look at it. All right, let's get back to your calls. If you want to keep talking about the Middle East, please do. If you want to bring up other subjects, I'm up for that as well. Peter Werby with you at 313-298-WRIF. And here's Joe. Joe's in Ypsilanti. Joe, welcome.
Hey, Pete. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I actually called at the very beginning of your first break, and I hung up. I'm like, oh, well, you know, why is it still ringing? Well, why isn't everybody from Dearborn calling, you know, to get their voices heard, and others who are outspoken at this point? But Debbie's call, you know, when she said something about the guys at the party store, I happen to work at a party store, and I happen to be as white as they come, and the guy that I work for happens to be as white as they come. And, you know, sometimes we have folks come into the party store that say, you know, well, we come down here, you know, because you guys are white, you know, and just spend our money at the white. And I'm seriously contemplating, you know, wearing a T-shirt to work that says, don't hate me because I'm black and don't love me because I'm white. And like Debbie, I was taking some notes, so I actually have a few things to bring up. One is, you know, I'm in my early 30s, and I am a high school dropout. I dropped out late, but I don't ever remember being educated on what Zionism is. And before you ask me the definition of it, I would just like to say that, like you, I'm an advocate of books and the Internet and other ways of, you know, finding out information. So I would just advocate all listeners to find out exactly what it is. And if you... I don't really want to promote a anti-Semitic website, and before I even say that, I lost members of my family to the Third Reich, and so I would put that up there to anybody who's going to call me anti-Semitic when I come out against the policies of the State of Israel. But at whatreallyhappened.com, Mike Rivero had a UN timeline. From the mid-40s through 1948 was when it the timeline ends, of Zionist terrorism in Palestine. And I mean, you can just see all these spots, you know, just certain dates, you know, such and such ship arrives from France with so many, as it's referred to then, illegal immigrants being transported to Palestine.
Sure. Let me just interrupt you to say that I have that site connected to mine, at Peter Werby, P-E-T-E-R-W-E-R-B-E, and you can go to right to, although it's out of my brain, what's the name of it again? What really happened. What really happened, yeah. And it gives a history of Israel-Palestine, the formation of the state, and it also gives the history of the terrorist acts that... The right-wing Zionist carried out, including...
Right down to the Likud party, which Sharon, I think they had a long-term plan for this. This was planned way before these kidnappings.
Sure. And Sharon, by the way, who's at death's door, who no sympathy for him. He deserves his place in some of the hottest rooms in hell. And I know you're not supposed to talk badly about the dead or close to dying, but here's a man that was condemned even by the judiciary of his own country for the war crimes that he allowed to happen when Israel invaded Lebanon in 1982.
The first time,
yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, just the timing of his falling ill, just a stroke for one, and then now his falling ill, the timing of it, it seems like they're kind of, you know, just using it as a springboard.
I doubt that very much. All right. Thank you very much, Joe. Appreciate your call. Yeah. It's important to know this this history. And like I said about my alleged ancestor, Light Horse Harry Lee, who was involved in guerrilla warfare in the Carolinas in fighting the British at the end of the 18th century during our revolution. He was condemned as a terrorist and he wouldn't take part in regular warfare. Well, you know, who's a freedom fighter? Who's a terrorist? Depends on who is, you know, who's making the call, I guess. All right. Well, I mean, I know. Well, let me put it this way. One of the reasons you can often figure out who is who's the bad guy in a situation, who's killing the most civilians, because everybody's got a reason. Everybody's got a reason why they are killing civilians, because for democracy or for theocracy or for Christianity or for Islam. But at the end of the day, when you wind up with dead kids and dead women and dead elderly and dead men civilians, I'm not very interested in any of those rationalizations. And when you look at something like Iraq, and you see this the stupendous toll that the United States military has taken on the Iraqi civilian population, 100,000, you go, what the hell? How could anything good come of a foreign force that invades under false pretenses, occupies this country, and then kills 100,000 people because we're trying to give them democracy? Hey, don't do me any damn favors, please. I'd hate for them to come to my neighborhood and try to, you know, change how we run things. Here's Stanley in Garden City. Hi, Stanley. You're on the air.
Good evening, Peter. How are you doing tonight?
Doing good. Thanks for calling.
Boy, I tell you, peace sells, but who's buying, like the song goes. You know, it's just one sad tune after another. But
there you go.
You know, here you got Bush going to send his fiddler on the roof, Condoleezza Rice. And boy, is she the ugliest broad I've ever seen.
Well, you know what? I'm not very sympathetic to that kind of talk. People can't help the way they look.
Yeah, I'm telling you, but still.
But you know what? I'll tell you, one of the reasons that she has that look, she's a horrible person. But again, let's not talk about people's looks.
Really evil and sinister about this. You're talking about religion tonight. Man, it's just something really bad about this entire thing. You know, Illuminati section, and I don't know. You're talking about religion, Jews against Arabs and Islam. It's just one big premeditated plan, like you said. And
Well, wait. I don't know if I said it was what I said was some of the specific things that are occurring here, like the invasion, the destruction of Hamas and Hezbollah were planned in advance. But I'm not going into any shadowy conspiracy. But thank you, Stanley, for your call. Here is Josh. Josh is in Sterling Heights. Hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Peter?
Hi.
Hi. This is my first time calling. First, I just want to share my opinion, and I want to share my gratitude. But my opinion refers back to Debbie, the other caller.
First caller, yeah.
Yeah. Well, she said that she justified those killings of those people, you know, because they rape and kill and whatnot. Well, I watch Free Speech TV, and what they showed on there was, you know, little babies being blown up and blown in half and skin being burned off of them and everything, and it's just like you said, there's raping and killing that goes on here in the States. And so should Israel come over here and bomb us because that's going on? Would that be justifiable? Because you know what I'm saying?
Sure. Yeah, I know exactly what you're saying.
And, you know, just to me, that woman who wrote in who was angry about, you know, ignorant Americans, you know, that also makes me mad because she has to think like that because there are actually people out there, and I can't really disagree with her, and that's what makes me mad. And I just want to share my gratitude with you, or, you know, I want to thank you, basically, because I've been listening to you for probably like 2 or 3 years now, and I've learned a lot, and I've learned a lot from other people calling in, and basically that's just all I wanted to say. I'm going to let some other people get in and call.
Well, thank you, Josh. I appreciate it very much, and, yeah, I learned stuff from people as well. People send me stuff. A lot of stuff appears on my website, peterwerby.com, I get from listeners, so thanks to all of you as well, and thanks for calling. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Here's Al from Inkster. Al, hi, you're on the air. Al, are you with me? Al, come on, you know the drill. One of my few regular calls. I can't believe this. He knows the drill. I'm going to put him back on hold. And let's go to Ryan. Ryan is in Dearborn. Hi, Ryan. Go ahead.
Hey, how's it going, Peter?
Going good.
Good. First off, I just like to thank you, man. I want to praise you for actually coming out like this and speaking to the public about this matter.
I thought this was my job. That's what I don't. I mean, what?
Well,
yeah,
you know. I always hear that, you know, when people speak out against, you know, certain things, that, you know, threats arise, and you know. You got the supporters behind you, and well, I really wanted to get down to, you know, the whole thing with the media and how they're covering it and the numbers that they're given. I mean, it just seems like they're giving false numbers on people that are really dying over there. I mean, they're using bombs, you know, they're not killing 20 or 30 people, they're killing thousands.
Well, let's hold that in abeyance. I mean, we don't want to exaggerate. There's enough untruths going around here. I'm not disputing what you're saying. I mean, the kind of damage that they're doing. I mean, I don't think anybody, and that includes me, that hasn't been in a situation like that, been in a civilian area where all of a sudden bombs are falling, could even imagine the kind of horror and terror. I mean, I rarely watch television because I usually think it's so empty of content. But I have been watching it some, a little of the cables, and I don't have cable TV, and so I've been watching like ABC News. And the terror that is in the eyes of these Lebanese civilians have nothing to do with Hezbollah or Israel or anything, but are just people whose lives are being shattered because of the policies of the United States and Israel is terrible. I don't know how, maybe it does. Maybe everyone's heart breaks when they see that. I hope so.
Well, you know, I heard some of your callers earlier speaking about, you know, the Illuminati and the Freemasons and anyone who's, you know, read the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion. You know, a lot of folks, they've seen this coming for a long time.
Wait. You think that there's anything to the Protocols of the Elders of Zion?
No. I think there's a huge link.
No, Ryan. This is a totally fabricated document that was manufactured by the Tsarist police to attack, to set the basis for pogroms, for attacks on Jews that were this helpless population captive essentially in Russia. I mean, the Jews in Russia were similar to the way that Palestinians are in Gaza today. And the Protocols of the Elders of Zion is a pure 100% fabrication, forgery, and linked only to the worst anti-Semites. To even bring this up erodes the validity of the speaker. So let me advise you to never mention it again. All right, thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. Our next one here. Sandy is in. Sandy, wait a minute. Hold on one second. I just want to say one more thing. There historically has been irrational anti-Semitism, or just anti-Semitism, period. I mean, irrational connected to anti-Semitism is an unnecessary adjective. By its very nature, anti-Semitism, as it was particularly prevalent in Europe from like the 13th century on or 12th century on, it was disconnected entirely with what Jews did. There was nothing they could do that was right or wrong that had anything that created anti-Semitism. It was all part of European society that just did not work. That was the society in collapse. That was quite mad. That had destroyed itself on every level. That was authoritarian rule. That was, you know, this insane theocracy. Environment had been destroyed. Continuous wars, and every once in a while, people would stop fighting each other and say, let's go burn out the Jews, or let's go kill the Jews. Or they would be going off to the Crusades to liberate Jerusalem from the infidels, the Muslims. And on the way, they would kill 100 or 200 Jews or something like that. So that and its culmination of European anti-Semitism resulted in the Holocaust, which was one of the most gruesome events in world history. I mean, it probably paled between, once you get into the millions, you don't want to start a derby. But I was mentioning earlier about the genocide of native people in the Western Hemisphere. But Israel then, which is a country, an exclusivist state, primarily of Jews, but also with an Arab population, has certain policy. Those policies, if you're like me, if you agree with me, you may not, are to be opposed, to be exposed, to be denounced, but it's nothing to do with Jews. It's nothing to do with the kind of tradition. Well, I mean, too much of it rises to that degree. Stick with the policies. Once you start going off in that direction, you cannot make serious political analyses. To say it's the Jews this or the Jews that, you're through. you've just got this cockamamie, theory that has no basis to it and only winds up in destruction. The idea to oppose the political and economic and military policies of a particular nation, that makes a lot of sense. Stick with that. I'm telling you, if you're going to talk with people that have any sense and you bring up stuff like the protocols, you're right away going to be relegated to the nutcase area. Or not, some people. I mean, unfortunately, a lot of U.S. allies have Egypt, who we give billions of dollars to, Saudi Arabia, who we give billions of dollars to, put forth. By the way, if you're wondering, what the hell am I talking about? What are the prodigals, the elders of Zion? This was the Tsarist police forgery showing that there was the secret cabal of Jews who used Gentile blood to make their matzah, this bread that they use on holidays and what have you. And it justified attacks on a helpless, defenseless people, which, of course, has a familiar ring to it. All right, so let's get rid of that crap. It goes nowhere, and it fogs the ability to make clear analyses. You're listening to Night Call. Peter Werby's my name, 313-298-WRIF. It's Sandy from Brooklyn, Michigan. Hi, Sandy. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. Good job as usual.
Thank you.
I have 2 points. My first one is a reality check, and this is sad.
Sure.
I'd like your listeners to imagine this. If they were running through the bombed-out streets of Lebanon with their families, with their children, imagine you have only the clothes on your back, no food, no water, no toilets, no change of clothes, no medical supplies. What if your child is hit by a bomb or shrapnel? Your child's leg could be left dangling with open flesh exposed. Your child's cheek could be torn off. Your child's hip could be hit. His backbone, his ear, his foot, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What if you saw your child burned alive?
Well, Sandy, wait a minute. Let me, before you get too much more graphic, I get it. But some, you know, I guess people that support Israel would say, yeah, but you could say the same thing about the Hezbollah rockets that are raining into Israeli cities.
They're not doing as much damage, and they have medical facilities to treat them. The whole point is that these people are running through the streets, and if they or their children get hit, they have no antibiotics to put on the wounds. They have, they have nothing.
No, I know, and Israel has been destroying the infrastructure, attacking ambulances, destroying hospitals, knocking out water systems. That's why the United Nations has suggested that this all may rise to the level of war crimes on the part of Israel.
Well, I believe it is. My second point is our media's brainwash on Friday. I listen to NPR all day. I listen to PBS's Jim Lehrer. And in Friday's USA Today, this is what they all said. I'll just read from USA Today. Secretary of State, the three little words that I'm talking about are as early as. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice will travel to the region as early as next week to seek a political solution, the State Department said.
Well, before you go into more reading, so what do we take from that? The fact that they're not acting expeditiously, they're letting this continue.
It's not only that, it's that if the general public don't know what's going on, they hear the words as early as, they're going to think that Condoleezza Rice is, you know, going there early.
Oh, yeah. Well, she's not. Sure. And one of the things that Ariel Sharon, the ex-prime minister and the ex-general who was involved in any number of massacres of Palestinian civilians from dating back to the 1950s, he was condemned by the Israeli judiciary for allowing Lebanese Christian militias to go into these refugee camps in 1982, and he just essentially gave them their way, and they slaughtered hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of Palestinian civilians that were there in refugee camps. So he just, you know, he didn't order them to do it. He didn't, he gave them enough time to do it. Sounds a little familiar. Thanks, Sandy. Now, I'm sorry, I owe this to the Waking Up store. This hour of Night Call is brought to you by Waking Up, Metro Detroit Sweatshop Free Clothing Store, located in the Universal Mall, 12 Mile in DeQuinder in Warren. You can go to their website, wakingupstore.com. Many of you who may remember the Fifth Estate newspaper from the 1960s, 70s, 80s, they sell that there as well. Still coming out. Yep. All right, let's see. Well, let's do this, and I think, it's the first spot. It's for the Waking Up Store. We'll be right back.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
On 101 WRIF Detroit, here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thanks a lot. Welcome back to our final segment. Boy, oh, I got something to read to you. But let me just tell you that at 1 a.m., we're going to have a couple of interviews. One with Victor Navasky. Victor Navasky was a longtime publisher of The Nation magazine. You should know that. If you want to, in fact, I start the interview off saying, if you wonder where I get my weird ideas, or if you don't think they're weird, where I get a lot of my information, thenation.com, thenation.com. World's oldest the U.S.'s oldest weekly magazine. And then also about, we're supposed to be a democratic country, is it? Now, the show began with a call from a woman named Debbie, and she got under my skin. I know Debbie's listening, so let me, before you get more insulted, let me finish this. She really got under my skin by saying that that her husband had been in Lebanon, that he knew that they had had this culture that was like sympathetic or something to rape and murder. And then I said, do you know any Lebanese? I said, she was making these slurs in the Lebanese people. And she said, do you know any Lebanese people? Because I know lots of people from Lebanon and people with Lebanese ancestry. Lots of them, in fact. Some of my dearest friends. And so she said, yeah, at a party store. And I said, oh, this woman, she's a racist and an idiot. And so we've been bashing Debbie ever since. So here's what she writes to me. I would like first to let you know that my husband served in Iraq, and he was also present in the 1980s during the attack that killed many of his friends. That was in, what, 1984 in Lebanon, because I said, you know, there's no Marines in Lebanon. So, you know, again, we could take everybody at face value at their word. I would also want you to know that when you asked me a question if I knew any Lebanese, I said, yes, I know a good friend who works at my local party store. His name is Wally. So that's how that's explained. I think that you hanging up on me was wrong due to the fact that you would not let me finish. I don't think you are what you say you are. How can you say you believe in freedom of speech if you don't give your listeners a chance to speak and explain if you don't believe in those views you hang up on them? I would love to talk to you again on the issue. Please call me and allow me to explain. Well, I'm not going to call you. But if I did you wrong, I apologize. But the way it was coming off, it was hard to come to any other conclusion. So that if I misread you, I apologize. But I would say that if your husband tells you that they have a culture that that affirms rape and murder, it's still doesn't sound real good to me. But if I was wrong, I apologize. Let's see. Let's get this one first, Al. Thanks, by the way. Al Slayer is doing the phones tonight, doing a great job of it. I'm going to go to Mohammed in Detroit first. Mohammed, hey, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air. Hi.
Yes, how you doing, Peter? Thank you for the show. It's excellent. We like it. It's that's all I listen to. This is my first time calling. Okay, this is how... I was actually born and raised in Kuwait.
Mm-hmm.
Here for a visit to the United States. Actually, I got here right before the war. When we got here, the next day, Saddam invaded Kuwait, so we stayed here. My parents are from Palestine. We came here, we stayed here, now we live here. We're good. And I haven't been to my country because of what's going on. The last I've been there to Palestine was when I was 7 or 6. I'm 25 now. What's going on over there in Palestine? It's sick. It's disgusting. I call my family members. They can't speak. They can't talk to you. If they say something, all the phone lines are tapped, whatnot, something would happen. That's all they tell you. Everything is okay. We're good. Everything's all right. Everything is good. There's no problems, blah, 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 blah. But we know that there isn't. We have the Arabic satellite. We watch it all the time. And it's just disgusting. Seriously, to see all these civilians just dying. For no point, for over two soldiers.
Wait a minute. Let me, in fact, I'm just reading. I never watch television while I'm doing the show. This is the first time I've ever done it. But here, the crawler says, relief officials say Beirut has been devastated by airstrikes. And so there's a humanitarian disaster taking place right now.
Exactly. And for that issue, that's crazy. I mean, if it wasn't for Syria, that's there to take people from, you know, to welcome them to their country, it would be crazy.
Yeah, I mean, totally, Syria's taken in about 100,000 people, but there's 500,000 people been blown out of their homes. Israel, I mean, can you imagine that if this was happening here in Michigan and Canada, say, you know, Canada was invading the U.S. and we weren't a big power, and they dropped leaflets on all of Detroit and the whole area and said, leave your homes. And we knew that if we didn't, there was going to be this army rolling through.
And you try to leave, and they'll get you somehow.
They shoot you on the roads, yeah.
Yes, exactly. I mean, if they don't shoot you, they'll, you know, launch a missile on you, Air Force or whatnot. But still, for the fact and that they actually think that they have the right and they're protecting their... I mean, start with your own. The United States is actually struggling. Everything is down. You want all the money, all the power. Gas prices are crazy. You have your own company, blah, blah, blah. Look after the little people. You know, there's people standing on corners when you get off highways, homeless, blah, 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 blah. And still you're going into war. You went for, let's say it started with Bin Laden.
Well, let's not go too deep into the history, Mohammed. But, yeah, when we say that I often say flushed hundreds of billions of dollars down this rat hole. It's not like it gets lost in the wash. This is all going into people's pockets. There's a certain portion of it that is just pure corruption. And if you read some of the papers in the back pages, they'll always say these people are being indicted over Iraq. But the other thing is, we just got billions of dollars away to countries in the Middle East. All right, Mohammed, thank you very much. I'm glad you're safe in Detroit. Let me get this long-distance call first. David in San Francisco, California. David, hi. Hi, you're...
Yeah, hi, Peter.
I don't think I'd ever see a day when it was warmer in San Francisco than it is in Detroit.
Oh, I know. It was pretty strange. I was lucky enough to go up to the Bohemian Grove thing yesterday, and it was 107 up a little north of us, so it was kind of unhealthy. And, this global warming thing is too much of a reality, and we're going to really have to start dedicating a lot of our time to, frankly, I think reforestation, whatever we can do to spend our time in putting in native plants and getting some trees planted. Putting the water back in the aquifers, whatever we can do to get the nature back to normal. It's kind of interesting. I wanted to raise a separate issue, in this discussion of the Eastern, of the Middle East, it really seems like the license to kill is at issue here. And Bush kind of seems like I've been calling a master race groupie. His neocon buddies, they pretend to be tied to Israel, and that if Israel or, the Jews are chosen of God, then if they're chosen of God and they can do whatever they want because God said so, if Bush hangs on them, then he can get to do whatever he wants, because he's like a master race groupie. And it's kind of an interesting, parasitical relationship, because it, sucks our budgets into, the authority of a king, and we the people don't get to spend our own tax dollars. So the idea of a license...
Well, we get to spend our own tax dollars. It goes to Carlyle Group and Northrop
right.
Grumman and Halliburton and Bechtel and all that, all of Bush's buddies.
Right.
I think, you know what, David, I think people put too much into, Bush may be a religious nut. I don't know whether he is or not. I mean, that he comes on like one. But it's mostly about power and money.
Oh, yeah. But to me, it's an excuse, his ties to the master race idea like them. Because, it's like I was saying about the taxation without representation, they've made it top secret to learn how our money is being spent. So, that's exactly what Eisenhower was warning about. But the real reason I called, I don't know if you heard about this, about 2 weeks ago, the U.S. Supreme Court was working on the Hamdan case. This was about the Guantanamo prisoners.
Right.
And apparently Senator Kyle of Arizona and Senator, Lindsey Graham of South Carolina.
Right.
They got together. They apparently acted like script writers. They wrote a 12,000-word debate that supposedly happened in the Senate. Then they had a crooked congressman submit it to the congressional record. Then they took the entry in the congressional record and submitted it to the Supreme Court as if it was a real debate in the Supreme or in the Senate as the intent of Congress on the Patriot Act and on the ability for getting due process.
Well, people wonder, or maybe the Congress wonders, why their approval rating is under 30%. All right, David, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Calling from San Francisco. This, by the way, is a little side note here. The BBC reported on July 19th, quote, more than 3,400 evangelical Christians have arrived in Washington to lobby lawmakers as part of the first annual summit of Christians United for Israel. Delegates have come from all 50 states and have 280 meetings on Capitol Hill on Wednesday, main organizer Pastor John Hagee said. Well, there's a lot going on here. I mean, these evangelical Christians, I mean, they think this is all bringing about the end days. And then, there's some quotes in here from there. But the most interesting thing about this little piece I just read, and so you got to really be observant. The BBC reported. Why? This is a British broadcasting company. I didn't see anything about this in our papers. But... let's see here. Sarah Posner, contributor to the Gadflyer, says, while American evangelical Christians have long allied themselves with what they claim to be Israel's interests, the rising political power of the Christian right, along with Republican dominance in Washington, has enabled them to extend their reach from their churches into the making of American foreign policy. So a lot of people want to put this off just on what the Israel lobby, where it's what's much closer to Bush is this far right wing base of these evangelical Christians who make up this Christians United for Israel. Earlier this year, San Antonio Evangelicus, televangelist John Hagee published an incendiary new book, Jerusalem Countdown, in which he claims that Iran, which he says is months away from the, producing a viable nuclear weapon, must be confronted. And where was this in here that, as a drumbeat of politicians and pundits clamored for war with Iran becomes louder, Hagee's role in mobilizing the shock troops in support of a military strike on Iran is becoming more clear. Prominent Republicans, including the head of the Republican National Committee, attended the group's events. While many Republicans may not adhere to Hagee's ideas about biblical prophecy, this dangerous marriage of convenience nonetheless produces public agenda for Bush's war agenda, public support for Bush's war agenda, as well as evangelical votes for the Republicans in November. Another guy says, too much there. All right, let's go back to your phones. 313-298-WRIF. It's Kevin in Ypsilanti. Hi, Kevin.
Yes, hi. How are you?
Good.
Great show.
Good, thank you.
I guess I had three comments. The first one was reserved for your first caller, Debbie. She said, you know, the culture there is one of murder and violence and rape. I guess she must have been sleeping when Abu Ghraib was going on, or when those two Marines, you know, raped that 11-year-old Iraqi girl and lit her body on fire after they were done.
There you go. Yeah.
I mean, maybe her husband might know something about it since he served in Iraq. Was he in the same, you know, platoon unit? Did he see anything, or were his eyes and ears closed? No.
Point two.
The second point that I had was that, you know, besides the fact that, you know, Lebanon is being bombed into, you know, submission, is the shameful silence of the Egyptian and Jordanian regimes, which basically, you know, not only are they not opening their borders, but they could bring this conflict to a resolution by at least, you know, putting pressure on Israel or threatening to make war.
They don't want
on
to.
Israel.
They want to have a compliant U.S. puppet, U.S.-Israel puppet state in Lebanon, and they want to they want Hezbollah destroyed, like Israel does. They're in
exactly.
agreement. They're in agreement with them.
So, I mean, this goes back to what Menachem Begin once said, and he was the man who first, you know, planned the first invasion of Lebanon, where he said that the Arab countries are Israel's first line of defense.
Yeah.
You know, and it makes sense because these countries are so shamefully silent. They sit there and do nothing. They're seeing everything happening, and they understand the problem better than most people probably here do because they have their intelligence services sniffing around all over the place, and yet they do nothing.
And number three?
And the third point is that the idea that, you know, you have an Arab and, you know, Arab and Jewish hatred, whatever, that point has actually been perpetuated since the founding of the State of Israel. Because if you historically look back at it, the most prominent Jewish intellectuals in the history of Judaism happened under Islamic rule in Spain. You know, and the greatest Jewish scholar, his name was Maimonides, he lived at a time when Muslims were in power in Spain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that, so this idea that there's a historical reason for an Arab and Jewish conflict, that they can't coexist, they can, but they cannot coexist in a, you know, colonial apparatus state like Israel.
All right, Kevin, thank you very much. Appreciate your comments. Let's see. Let's go to Al. Al from Inkster. He says he got disconnected earlier. I don't buy that, Al. Come on.
Well, something went wrong.
You weren't paying attention. I heard commotion on the other end. Go ahead. I'm just giving you a hard time.
The Latin phrase you're looking for is illegitimi non carborundum.
Don't let the bastards grind you down.
Yep. My dad claims it's our family motto because against everybody.
Okay.
Secondly, I want to talk about, you know, talking about the Israel. It's funny that, you know, three religions that so preach peace and forgiveness and understanding have come to loggerheads, you know, in the Middle East. I mean, each one of the religions, that's the basic thing, is preaching forgiveness, you know, preaching peace.
Yeah, what's up?
I don't know. I just...
Doesn't make me a big fan of religion any more than I ever was.
I never was a big fan of religion either, but like you were talking that the first caller, Debbie.
Yeah.
You know.
But what do you think? She says we got her wrong.
Yeah, she does, but the Christian thing to do is to reach out and try and touch her and show her where she's got it wrong.
Well, she wanted to talk more, and she was right. I did cut her short. And yeah, she says that contradicts what I say. Well, we'll see. Thanks, Al. Let's see. Here's Scott in Lincoln Park. Scott, hi. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. I originally called to make a couple points, but I just wanted to thank you so much for pointing out the forgery of the protocols of the Elders of Zion from that previous caller.
Sure.
I always commended you, even amongst my friends who don't really care for you, that you do always stop the anti-Semitism.
Well, let me say this. I just saw, I don't know, I can't remember the name. I saw a documentary recently.
Protocols of Zion?
Was that the name of it?
It played at the Main Art.
Yeah. I saw it, a preview copy of it. And it was astounding how many people considered them valid.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, I hate to say it, but it's a big seller in the Arabic markets as well.
Well, they now, of course, a lot of these Arab regimes, including our buddies in Egypt and Saudi Arabia, who we give billions of dollars of our money to, they produce, they print the book, this forgery that is just this, you know, libel on a whole people. And they have, like, television specials on this protocols, which is total nonsense. And if you start seeing the world in terms of... Anybody that sees the world in terms of ethnicity as their main lens through which to see the world is going to come up with some bad answers.
I believe there's actually been motion pictures based on it as well.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah.
Could I just make one really quick point here?
Sure.
Okay, regarding the UN resolutions against Israel that some of your previous callers were talking about, it's very true that there have been a ton of UN resolutions against Israel. You pointed out a lot of them had to do with the disputed territories, you know, quote-unquote, which you can argue about that forever. A lot of them also have to do with, like, you know, there would be a suicide bombing. Israel would, you know, retaliate, and they would condemn the retaliation, not the suicide bombing. Some of them were like for a military parade in Jerusalem. There was a resolution against that. Looking at that in context, however, there have been no UN resolutions against China, Syria, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Malaysia, even though human rights groups have been complaining to the UN about violations in those countries for ages. I mean, even Sudan, there hasn't been a UN resolution against Sudan, for God's sake. And, I mean, we all know what's going on there.
Well, there sure should be. And there's a suggestion, and I hear it, and what you're saying is that Israel is being you know, singled out for special attention. And maybe because it is still within the European galaxy, that and also Israel's self-definition. Also, there's great opposition within that area, within the Middle East, so... Maybe that, hey, you want some opposition for what's going on in all those countries that you mentioned? They sure deserve it. All right, I got to run because I'm almost out of time. Thank you. Let's see. Here is Mike in Northville. Mike, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter, it's Mike. I've listened to your show about 3 times. I don't agree with everything you say, but it's America, right?
Sure.
You know, the reason I'm calling is because I'm seeing a lot of, you know, acts perpetrated by the United States government and the mainstream media, along with the Israeli government. I don't see anybody doing anything about it. I mean, Israel, over 2 soldiers, they're allowed to go into Lebanon and, you know, bring a country to its knees. It's in the Middle East, in a land of historic Islamic, you know, basically fascism. And they're just trying to get on their feet, establish a democracy, and, you know, some Islamic radical organization is allowed to hold this country hostage. And...
Well, don't you think really that Israel is holding the whole region hostage because of its refusal to exit from the territories that it occupies illegally, the West Bank and Gaza? Israel has no right to maintain those in any manner, and they say that they support a Palestinian state, but that's absolutely not true. The last thing in the world that Israel is ever going to support is an independent, autonomous state. It just ain't going to happen. I got to get a couple more calls. Let's see. I'll get the one with the... Here's Jeff. Jeff, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter, how are you?
Quick statement for me, please.
I just wanted to, you know, when we talk about religion, people get really hot at it. I want to take this back to, like, a security perspective, ask you what you thought Israel needs to be doing, because I'm not forgetting about the continuous rockets that have been falling since they pulled out of Lebanon in 2000. This isn't a new conflict. There have been rockets raining on Israel since 2000. And we say two soldiers, it was actually 10, 8 that were killed and 2 that are kidnapped.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to go back to your last statement, if Canada were to cross, if Detroit were to cross into Canada's borders and create an aggressive attack and they invaded us, I don't think we'd be out of place. I want to know why the people in Lebanon haven't denounced at all Hezbollah. I'm aware.
Well, many of them have. The half the population, which is Christian, is not very friendly whatsoever to Hezbollah. I don't think the Druze are, but it's they're able to maintain this independent militia, and they are respected by a lot of Lebanese because of their willingness to stand up to to Israel, which has maintains sections of Lebanon that has kidnapped Lebanese the civilians. That's one of the reasons that Hezbollah did what it did. It thought it would be able to kidnap these or capture, depends on kidnap, capture, you know, whatever, kidnap them, and they'd be able to bargain. They didn't think that Israel would respond by destroying the entire country. All right, thanks a lot. Here is Rob in Milwaukee. Rob, you got about 1 minute.
Okay, well, hey, Peter, good talking to you. Listening to you over here. I'm from Detroit originally, but I love hearing your show on Sunday night. But
well, thank you.
Real quick, just wanted to pose you a real quick question, because I think you'd give a good answer to this, but if right now you could put a candidate or a person in office to replace Bush to get us out of the situation, or I guess we're not really in the situation yet, but to best resolve all the issues in the Middle East that we have, who do you think has the best head on their shoulders for that?
Ralph Nader. Should be the president. All right, Rob, thank you for being our last caller. Thanks for listening. Thanks for calling. Got some interviews coming up. Please stay with us. Talk to you next week.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Radio Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in a contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are non-transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
This is WRIF.com.
Make up your mind. Decide to walk with me. Around the lake tonight. Around the lake tonight. Gentlemen, behind.
More Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. People often ask, where do you get the ideas that you have, Werby? I haven't heard anything like that. Where do you get these strange ideas that seem so far out of the mainstream? Of course, many of the ideas that I have eventually become the mainstream, and it's just, where do you find them first rather than 111th? But one of the places I have over the years is The Nation magazine, and it's a pleasure and an honor to bring to our microphones Victor S. Navasky. He's the National Book Award-winning author and the former publisher and editorial director of The Nation, and currently he is the Delacorte Professor of Journalism at Columbia University. He's the author of Naming Names, which won the National Book Award in 1982, also another title, Kennedy Justice. We're talking to him in New York City. Victor Navasky, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
It's good to be with you.
And I'm sorry to have to ask you this as the first question, but I'll bet you there's some in our audience that don't know what The Nation magazine is. Tell us just briefly the history.
Okay. Well, first of all, read A Matter of Opinion, new book that tells the history. But secondly, it's America's oldest weekly magazine, founded in 1865 by a group of people in and around the abolitionist movement. We have, in the magazine business, survival is the ultimate test of success. And The Nation, which is a small circulation journal of opinion on the left, has survived where magazines with circulations in the millions, like Look and Life and Saturday Evening Post and Collier's, have gone under. So I maintain it's the most successful magazine, weekly magazine in the country.
You're right. I didn't even mention that we're going to talk to you about your political memoir, A Matter of Opinion. Thank you for that, because in there, in over 450 pages, Victor Navasky's essentially your story. You were the magazine's editor from 1978 to 1995, and then the publisher and editorial director for another 10 years. You were an editor at the New York Times Magazine. What in the world, someone would say, would you go from the big time to the margins?
Well, you know, that's the way some people look at it. I saw it as a step up, but I was a sub-editor on the New York Times Sunday Magazine. I'd written 16 articles for them, and I left to write a book, the book about the Hollywood blacklist, and then as you mentioned, in 95, I got to come to The Nation. And the fact is, magazines like The Nation, which have tiny circulations, have enormous influence, way disproportionate to their numbers. And one of the reasons is that their audience, their subscribers, are people who are interested in ideas, but they're also people who write the nightly news, who either are members of Congress or who are the legislative assistants to members of Congress. They are teachers at the high school, grammar school, and college and graduate school levels. So they're people of real influence. And a magazine like The Nation feels good when a story appears in the Detroit Free Press or the New York Times saying, in The Nation last week, they said such and such. But the real test of influence is when you read an editorial and they cite a fact that they had to have gotten from The Nation, because it's about Liberia, and your writer got back from Liberia, reported this fact 2 weeks ago, and they don't credit you, but it's appeared nowhere else. So there's a deep penetration of these journals, and they put new issues on the national agenda. A magazine like The Nation, for example, was the first to publish a young law student from Harvard, Ralph Nader, on unsafe cars. It was the first to run a national civil rights audit by an unknown Southern minister named Martin Luther King. It was the first to publish Jimmy Baldwin. Toni Morrison is on our editorial board, where it's a very unique kind of thing.
You mentioned, Victor Navasky, when you first described the publication you were so associated with, The Nation, you said it's a magazine of the left. Now, when we talk about the New York Times, which you worked for, that's supposed to be an objective newspaper where,
right,
when you say the left, that appears partisan. And some people will say,
right,
well, that makes me a little suspect, because they're
right,
going to bend the news to fit their ideology.
Right. Okay, well, here's my view about that. It is true The Nation is ideological and has the ideology of the left. And National Review, Bill Buckley's magazine, is ideological and has the ideology of the right. The New York Times, Time and Newsweek, all the networks claim to be objective and claim they have no ideology. The fact is, they have the ideology of the center. And it is part of the ideology of the center to deny that one has an ideology. And I give interns at the Nation an exercise to, that where to discover what the ideology of the center is. But if you leave out inconvenient facts, or if you distort, the news, or if you stack the deck on behalf of your ideology, whether it's the left, the center, or the right, those are your assumptions where you start from. That's bad journalism. And the advantage of a magazine like The Nation or National Review, with whom we have great disagreements with, is that we are open about our political values and assumptions, so the reader can argue with them. If you pretend you don't have any, then the reader is at a disadvantage. And so that's the way I see this question of left, right, center.
You keep using the pronoun we. You still, what do you have an affiliation, or is it just,
well,
just deep tie?
Actually, I'm the chairman of the Columbia Journalism Review, which is an impartial cover of journalism by its own self-description. But we try to be at Columbia open about the fact that we are very supportive of First Amendment values. My affiliation with The Nation is that I am a shareholder in it. I am a publisher emeritus, which means that I have no power within the magazine, but I will write for it occasionally. I occasionally attend editorial board meetings, and I still have a little office down there.
Mm-hmm. Now, my own personal opinion is that if one is honest and one desires what is good for the vast majority of humanity, it comes out with a left perspective.
Well, now we're talking. But, you know, for years we had a very bad joke at The Nation. We said, if it's bad for the country, it's good for the nation. So if people say, how are you doing? I would say, better than ever. And the truth is that this magazine, The Nation, which lost money for 140 years, which, by the way, I think is part of the secret of its success, because its owners considered it a public trust and cared more about the cause than the business. The last 3 years, I had to send a letter of apology before I passed on the magazine to Katrina Van Uvel. The last 3 years, I had to send a letter of apology to our shareholders because I had told them they'd get a tax loss and they had to pay a few pennies in taxes.
Oh, well, this is, of course, a reaction to the presidency of George W. Bush.
Yes,
yeah,
that's part of it.
Well, my guest is Victor Nevasky. He has put out a political memoir, A Matter of Opinion. And tell me a little about the title. Is that one you selected, or was that the publisher after reading it? And if it's yours, what does it mean exactly?
Yeah, well, I selected it, and, you know, I set out to write a book that would answer the question, are these journals, like The Nation or The New Statesman in England or The Weekly Standard, Murdoch's magazine, are they a relic of the 17th and 18th century in this age of the internet and of television and of the soundbite, or are they a counterforce against all of the degrading trends in contemporary journalism, among which I include conglomeratization, sensationalization, bureaucratization, Murdochization, Oprahfication, you know. And I thought that no one had ever written a book about this before, and it was something I could do sitting at my desk putting out The Nation, because it wouldn't require extra research because I'd be reading all the other magazines and doing so. It turned out I couldn't do it sitting at my desk. I had to take a sabbatical, and in the middle of sabbatical, my publisher made me an offer I should have refused, sold me the magazine for money I didn't have, and I had to spend the rest of the year raising money. And at that point, I changed the magazine from the book from a third-person meditation to sort of a first-person misadventure story. And I showed it to the first draft to my son, who read all of 3 pages, and he said, oh, I get it. It's a how not to. And then I showed it to my editor, and she gently nudged me in the direction of chronological coherence. She was very enthusiastic. So then the book became more about me and my ideas on opinion than I had originally intended it to be, and that became its title.
Again, the book, Matter of Opinion, Victor Navasky, my guest on the Peter Werby Show. Let's look a little at the countervailing sources of information. When I was just coming up, there were two publications I waited for, and one was the National Guardian, as it was called at the time. The other was The Nation. And there was zero other sources until...
Well, you're at all subversive. But, you know, my first job out of law school was... I was a speechwriter for Soapy Williams, G-Man and Williams from Michigan.
Yeah, the governor of Michigan, yeah.
Yeah, and the two sources of information that I looked to were the Free Press and the Detroit News. And neither of them ever got it totally right, I thought, which is one of the things that made me, and I had always subscribed, my parents had always subscribed to The Nation and The New Republic. And one of the things that I suggested to Soapy was this was in 1960 when the Kennedy presidential campaign was coming on, was that he write an article about what was happening in the party, and I did an outline for it, and we came up with something, and The Nation published it. And it was so, ironically, the first article I ever published in The Nation was under the name of G-Men and Williams.
Huh. That's amazing. But the point I was making is that now when Israel invades Lebanon, and all I'm getting is the Detroit News or the Detroit Free Press, which still doesn't get it right, is my estimation, is that I can, as you know, and as you probably do as well, half an hour later, we're reading blogs and information and stuff and or right from the scene. So it certainly erodes to some extent the special character of the publications when there wasn't an internet.
Well, I think for a lot of people, this, especially people who don't live in New York or Washington, the magazine is a lifeline, and it's because they don't trust their local papers, and the national papers, there's news that they don't report, and their perspectives that are not contained in it. And I quote in the book a call I got. It was on my voicemail when I was finishing the book, and this is from a 68-year-old widow. Let me just read you a couple of sentences. She says it's a very funny letter, but it shows the role a magazine like this can play in people's lives. She said, "I need to ask a favor of you. I'm stuck in Abbeville, Louisiana, and I want to move, but I want to move somewhere where I can see a Democrat before I die. It occurs to me that you might be able to rummage up a place where people are actually subscribers to The Nation, where I would have somebody to talk to. I don't want their names or anything. I just want a town where there are a few kindred souls." And then she added, "If you would call around noon, I'd be grateful. I'm about to cut the grass." So there it is.
I love it. Well, there was. Is there still existing these Nation groups that meet based on
the
magazine?
There are 50 of them around the country, yes. And if you write into the magazine, Peg Randall will tell you where they are in your neighborhood.
You can even go online. Is it? I think it's thenation.org?
www.thenation.com.
Thenation.com, yes, for America's oldest. What's the...
Well, we're the oldest weekly magazine in the country.
All right, good. You, Victor Navasky, are currently the Delacorte Professor of Journalism at Columbia University, and I wonder how young people are looking at the world of information where on one hand you have print journalism, on the other, electronic. I mean, when I find it extraordinarily difficult to read long, serious analyses, critiques online. I print them out, or that's why I like the magazine. You can sit there and you can stop and you think about it. How do they feel? What does it look like younger people coming up think?
Well, we have a great intern program, and we get 400 applications for 7 summer intern jobs. So we have a constituency among the younger people. But I'll tell you something. When I came to The Nation in 1978, we had 20,000 paying readers. Last year, we got 40,000 paying subscribers who came to the magazine over our free website. And most of those are younger. And so now we have close to 200,000 subscribers, and the average age has gone down.
What do you think about the idea of reading on the internet? I don't think much of it, but like maybe, as you said, I'm just an old subversive.
Yeah, there's a big paradox about that. As you said, and most people will tell you, that if an article is over about 1,200 words, it's tough to follow on the Internet, on people's eyes, or whatever reason is, they can't do it. But the paradox is that the Internet is infinite, that it has an infinite capacity. You could have hundreds of thousands of words on it, whereas a magazine is only 40-odd pages, so...
Tell me about some of the people. I was somewhat of a fan of one of your column writers, Christopher Hitchens, but it seemed like he had just sort of tumbled over into the right wing some and just became sort of this curmudgeon, dyspeptic character when I've seen him I can't even think of the guy's name, though. I saw him on television a couple of times. But he says about your book, someone had to keep the left flag flying in a matter of opinion. Your book, Victor Novasky, exhibits malice towards none.
Well, Christopher wrote that in Vanity Fair, where he nominated me for their Hall of Fame or something, after he had quit our magazine, because he claimed that we were wrong on what he regarded as the three great moral issues of our time, the latest being the Iraq War. And, I told him he shouldn't leave, because his column was called Minority Report. He should be a minority voice in there, and we're ready to, the old Christopher, I told him, would have stuck around for the argument, but he preferred to conduct the argument in other venues, and that's his decision. But yeah, he was very combative and is an elegant writer, but we've got a lot of those in the magazine. There's no one quite like Christopher, but I think Katha Pollitt is one of the great voices in our country writing today, and has a huge following within the magazine. Alexander Coburn is a brilliant polemicist. Eric Alterman wrote the definitive book on the charge that the media are dominated by liberals. His book is called What Liberal Media? So we've got a lot of good voices, and it's an impressive roster.
Yeah, it's not like if you disagree with the editors, you get bounced, because you mentioned Alexander Coburn, who frequently goes out of his way to not speak highly of the management.
Well, that's an understatement. I say in the book that if I were better organized, I would have had two form letters. One would, for people who say that the only reason they subscribe to this magazine is Alex Coburn, and if you fire him, they're canceling their subscription, which a lot of other people recommend. And the other would be to people who say they're quitting their subscription because they can't stand Alex Coburn's column. So I would have had two letters telling them each, hey, listen, you don't have to read Alex if it upsets you that much, but read it this week and you might learn something.
It is interesting. Like, my father falls in the latter category. He reads them every week or every, what is it?
Every other week.
Every other week, yeah. Actually, and he is an interesting guy. I once, last year, wrote him a 10, I know him vaguely, I wrote him a 10-word email, to which he turned into a column on his website denouncing me for every crime.
Congratulations. Welcome to the club. You're in the most distinguished writers, commentators in America, if Alex has denounced you.
How does it, how does one function as an editor and a publisher when you have writers that aren't used to submitting, that they're, the Alexander Coburns, the Christopher Hitchens, and I suspect, because I do some editing and deal with people somewhat like that, that they're angry if you remove a comma. How does one, if you will, manage them?
Well, our columnists, we have a deal, and that is that we invite them to write a column every other week because we admire their style and what they have to say, and not that we always agree with them. And they'll produce copy regularly, and we'll honor that admiration, although they get it like everybody else. With Calvin Trillin, our house humorist, we had a no-diddling clause, which is we wouldn't change a word without his okay. But he would give his okay when we made the case that there ought to be changed. But those are very special writers, and they're entitled.
And when the nation, when the nation is a forum in many ways for the left, does it have a particular political point of view? I mean, there's always been so many competing trends on the left. Is there one that you would say the nation identifies with specifically, and does it try to promulgate that? And
yeah.
Okay, which is what?
Okay, the nation is not a, we don't have a party line, and we're not the voice, and the original prospectus said that the magazine would not be the organ of any party or movement. However, we're not a forum for the debate between the Democrats and the Republicans. We're a forum for the debate between the radicals and the liberals. And we have lots of differences of opinion within our magazine, but there's a shared set of values and a perspective which is generally liberal, progressive, in favor of racial equality, in favor of civil liberties, political, civil, and human rights, against imperial adventurism. And once you get beyond these great categories, and on behalf of those who can't take care of themselves, and on behalf of the dispossessed, once you get beyond those broad categories, a lot of disagreement within our camp.
Speaking of ASCII, you mentioned towards the beginning of this conversation that there was a number, and I don't remember them all, these problems with journalism, which was the centralization of it, the increasing small ownership of so many different organs, bureaucratization, sensationalism, and it all seems to be going that way. I mean, is there any hope that that we're going to be able to blunt that and have some serious journalism?
Well, I think the combination of all of these independent voices is one hope, and that's a thin reed, but it's a reed, and the fact that they have staying power is very impressive. And there's a new little organization called the Independent Press Association, which has 400 members of their publications have tiny circulations. Some of them are Chicano, some of them Hispanic publications, minority voices, but they are doing very important things. Secondly, you have the blogosphere. And while there's a lot of misinformation out there right now, it has a great potential for not only interconnectivity, for linking up, but as you've seen in the case of politics, where they've shown that politics is not enslaved to big money anymore, that you can actually finance campaigns in little bits and pieces, and eventually all those voices are going to be part of the national dialogue, and magazines like The Nation are going to help to put new issues on the national agenda. So that to me is the hope, rather than that the large media companies that are increasingly conglomerated and concentrated are going to cure themselves.
Victor Novasky, in a matter of opinion, you described the book to some extent as a chronicle of misadventures. If there was one thing you would that you chronicle in here that you would have say, oh, if I could only do it again, what would that be? Or isn't there anything that bad?
Well, yeah, there are too many things. One little specific thing. We had on our editorial board a great philosopher, Sidney Morgenbesser. And we've run a series of debates that we run at town hall. Sometimes we debate National Review on issues like health care or affirmative action. And but they're conventional subjects. And Sidney came in one day, Reagan was president, and he said, I have a subject for debate that we should do. And what is it? And he said, is Reagan a moral disaster? And we didn't do it. And we should have done it. It would have been, it's the real big question. And we didn't see that at the time. But I see it now. So.
Well, in a long and distinguished career, if that's the one thing you regret.
One among many.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the rest of it you'll have to read in A Matter of Opinion. The political memoir by Victor Novasky, the publisher emeritus of The Nation. And you can go to thenation.com. The book is published by Picador. Thanks so much for being with me on the PWR
Show. Thank you, Peter. This is Red.
Got a buck? Get a song.
Can I get a holla, holla?
Log on to WRIF.com and check out the digital music store. Any riff song is available for just 99 cents online. Browse by artist, title, or riff playlist. Easy and cheap. The Riff Digital Music Store at WRIF.com. Everything.
Get into it.
That
rocks. You're listening to WRIF.com.
On WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. I think all of us know from our high school civics class and from the kind of the story of America, what makes us unique is that we're a democracy. It means that we vote in our representatives and we're protected by a specific document, the Constitution of the United States and its Bill of Rights, in terms of what political rights we have. That's what makes us a democracy. And ultimately, though, it's in the voting. So is this safe? Is the procedure something that we can count on? There are people that charge that the 2000 and 2004 election were stolen. There's great concern about electronic voting. Let's bring to our microphone Spencer Overton. He's got a brand new book. It's called Stealing Democracy, The New Politics of Voter Suppression. And Spencer Overton is professor at George Washington Law University. He served on the Jimmy Carter, James Baker Commission on Federal Election Reform and sits on the boards of Common Cause, Demos, and the Center for Responsive Politics. Spencer Overton, really, welcome home.
Peter, thanks so much for having me.
You're from the Detroit area, eh?
I am. I grew up in Detroit proper, and then also grew up in Southfield, Michigan as well. Went to Southfield High.
Well, good, good. It's good to have people always that are spreading Detroit out through throughout our nation. Tell us about Stealing Democracy. Most of us feel that probably the two major problems with our democracy is A, people don't vote, and B, that big money plays such a role. But you talk about the new politics of voter suppression. Talk to us a little about that.
Peter, politicians control America by manipulating election rules. We talk a great game in this country about exporting democracy to other nations, but in fact here in the United States, people are not in control. Politicians use redistricting and a variety of other barriers to voting to determine who votes and whose vote counts. Peter, voters don't choose politicians right now, but politicians often choose voters by manipulating the election rules. So this is a big, significant problem in our nation, and we need to address it.
Maybe we should go even to the origins of our country. When we talk about with the civil rights slogans of a generation ago in the 1960s, one man, one vote, It was certainly much less than that embodied in our Constitution. Tell us about who voted originally and how the vote was extended over the, say, 150 years or so.
Well, generally, as we started out in terms of this country, the vote was often limited to propertied white males, people who owned property. The thought was that they were vested and could make decisions for other people. And as time, as things evolved, property taxes were relaxed. And in the 1800s, after the Civil War, the right to vote was extended to African Americans on a national basis in the Constitution. And later on, women were included, and Native Americans were included in terms of the franchise. So it really has been an ever-expanding notion that we really do want to include, and we want a government that reflects the will of the people rather than just virtual democracy where one person, such as, let's say, a propertied white male, speaks and represents other people around him, that we really do need widespread participation to be a legitimate democracy.
So we finally get everyone included, and now we're starting to face all of these problems. You talked about redistricting, sometimes called gerrymandering, the way these districts wind up in these that will ensure, that's what I think what you meant about politicians picking their voters. They want to assure that they will get elected, and if it's got to be a real odd...
Both Republicans and Democrats do this, Peter. Let's just say, for example, I'm a Republican and I won narrowly in my last election with only 51% of the vote, and that's just too close for me. Well, I redraw my district to pick up some more Republican precincts and to exclude some Democratic precincts, and in the next election I win with 70% of the vote. It's a landslide, and I don't win by that margin because I'm a better representative. I win because I've simply shuffled the voters. And both Democrats and Republicans do this across the country. In 2004, Congress only had a 4% approval rating, but 98% of the incumbents won and went back to Washington, D.C. So this is a massive problem in terms of the fox guarding the hen house.
Yeah, I was going to say, but in a sense you answered it. I was going to say both Democrats and Republicans do it. It's sort of a wash, but there's other aspects at issue here, I suspect.
Well, there are a couple of things here. Number one, we don't want to just say since both do it, everything's okay. And the reason we don't want to do that is because this really needs to be about the voters. It shouldn't be about, you know, whichever party is savvy enough to game the rules. They are the people who are elected and control the legislature. It should really be up to the people. We defer to political elites to the extent we just say, oh, Republicans and Democrats do it, it's okay. Another problem, Peter, is that sometimes Republicans and Democrats are in cahoots with one another. If you were to look in California following the last round of redistricting, both Democrats and Republicans worked together to make their own districts safer to benefit incumbents. So I'll give you an example.
Sure.
Michael Berman did the redistricting. His brother, Howard Berman, a Democrat in Congress, and Michael reduced the number of Latinos in Howard's district from 45% down to 31% so that Howard would not face a Latino challenger. So it's a great example of incumbents basically drawing their own districts to entrench themselves, not just to get partisan gain and partisan pickup for their party. All of the districts in California, pretty much all of them, were made safer, and those that had been very competitive were made safer. So it's a major problem across the country where the voters really just don't have as much voice as a result of these politicians redrawing the lines.
Well, Spencer Overton, this is almost a question I should save towards the end, but I was thinking about this as I was reading through your book. This discussion could actually serve to make people, not maybe more cynical, but to affirm the kind of cynicism that they have about the electoral process with the belief that their vote doesn't really mean much, and rather that all of these decisions are made by elites, certainly economic decisions, but now we learn political decisions as well, where these men can insulate themselves so much from popular control.
Right. It does initially seem that way, but we can't let that happen. You know, politicians would love to do things behind closed doors and to basically discourage us from participating. We need to participate. We need to get out. And frankly, if you're not registered to vote already, you can do that. If you go to stealingdemocracy.com, you can register to vote online. And if you've moved and you need to update your registration, you can do that at stealingdemocracy.com as well. Peter, politicians do this often kind of in the dead of the night or when other people aren't looking. If you just look in Michigan, for example, with the last round of redistricting, politicians basically had their debate in the middle of the night. They finished up at about 2 a.m. at night with little fanfare, and then the final plan was signed by Governor Engler on a very special day on September 11th, 2001. He signed the plan just a couple of hours after the World Trade Center collapsed, and obviously that didn't get very much press attention because the world was focused on New York City and the Twin Towers. So politicians really don't like this kind of public scrutiny. So we shouldn't get discouraged. We should, though, scrutinize and ask tough questions and really put some sunshine and some have some disclosure of these procedures.
And that last Republican redistricting you spoke of, that meant, I hope I'm not confusing, is it Lynn Rivers? Was it she the one that was just sort of disappeared from the political scene because of the redistricting there, which brought in Thaddeus McCotter down in the Dearborn Heights, sort of Ann Arbor area? I think.
Right. I think maybe Lynn Rivers and maybe John Dingell were maybe pitted against one another.
That's right.
That was a direct result of the redistricting by the state legislature. I think what's important, though, Peter, is not to say that this is a Republican problem. It's not an issue where just Republicans engage in this. You know, if we do that, then it sounds like sour grapes, and that's not the case. And there are a lot of people who really are honest, very good people who want to shoot fairly here rather than unfairly, who would just say, oh, you're just talking politics, you're just talking sour grapes to the extent this is politicized. So it's not a Republican issue, it's not a Democrat. Democrats engage in this behavior as well. It's really more about the political elites versus the people.
Spencer Overton is my guest on the Peter Werbe Show. The book is Stealing Democracy, The New Politics of Voter Suppression. It's published by Norton, and you can go to the website stealingdemocracy.com, and according to our guest, you can also register to vote, change and update your address, make sure you're in compliance as well. Now, one of the things that your book, Stealing Democracy, talks about is what you call a patchwork electoral system. So you have all these different sets of voting rules. And from some of the publicity material I'm looking at, it says because the right to vote is based on where you live, voters in favored districts cast ballots quickly, while other voters navigate three-hour lines and antiquated punch card machines. Now, in Ohio in 2004 for the presidential election, if you got out of there in 3 hours, you were doing swell.
That's right, Peter. Right now, your right to vote depends on where you live. We've got 4,600 different election systems. All of them have different rules in this country, and unequal funding, unequal opportunities to cast a ballot. Just in Columbus, Ohio, you mentioned Ohio, election officials knew they needed 5,000 voting machines, they decided to make do with only 3,000. And they moved machines from the urban areas out into the suburban areas. As a result, Tanya Thivner, she waited 4 hours to vote in line in the city of Columbus, whereas her mother, who lived in a suburb, waited only 15 minutes to vote. Voters were really just treated like cattle. Also, Dorothy Turner voted in Ohio. She was an 80-year-old woman. She stood in line for 2.5 hours. She said that she stood there even though her back hurt and no one offered her a chair. She stood there because she thought it might be the last time she cast a ballot. Now, Peter, Starbucks and McDonald's, they don't make people wait 2.5 hours or 4 hours in line. They'd go out of business if they did that. But I think that voting is at least as important as a Frappuccino, as a quarter pounder, and we can and we should do better. We really do need some federal standards and some federal oversight. Certainly local officials, I think, still have a very important role to play in terms of administering elections, but we need federal funding as well as some federal checks and oversight to ensure that, frankly, we don't have four-hour lines.
I have to say, these people that did this stand in those have more endurance than I do. Had I been faced with that, I think I, like others, would have left.
Well, I think that's right. I think the prediction is in Ohio there are about 175,000 people who went to the polls but who didn't vote and who were discouraged because of the long lines. There are a lot of people who didn't vote, and you really do have to give a lot of you really have to thank the people who stood in line because they really did make a contribution to democracy.
Well, let's talk about who doesn't make a contribution to democracy. Certainly the charge has been made that, and the subtitle of your book, Stealing Democracy, is The New Politics of Voter Suppression, that this was not an accident, that the too few voting booths or voting machines was purposefully done by the Secretary of State in Ohio, and this was particularly done in African-American districts that were seen to have were predicted, I'm sure, quite correctly, to vote for John Kerry. This is why many people say that the election was stolen in Ohio. How do you come down on that, Spencer Overton?
Well, I think one of the big problems we have in this country, Peter, is that partisans administer elections on both the local level and the statewide level. In Florida, we had Catherine Harris in 2000. She was the chair of the Bush-Cheney campaign. We had Ken Blackwell in Ohio in 2004. He was chair of Bush-Cheney in Ohio. And Democrats do the same thing. And the problem is that whether it's a mistake or whether it's intentional, because the conflict of interest exists, there are always going to be lingering doubts. And we have this problem in this country of partisans administering elections, and we should move toward independent administrators to administer elections. Even in a place like Iraq, the democracy that we set up, there is an independent commission that administers elections as opposed to partisans administering them. So we need to professionalize this, and so that when we do professionalize it, we can get out of this notion of, hey, Ken Blackwell, did he do it intentionally? Was it just a big mistake? The problem is that it occurred, and the problem is that there's a conflict of interest that exists, and we need to move past that by just changing the structure as a whole.
Yeah, I may be beating a dead horse, but this is patterned, of course, and the most votes suppressed in 2000 and the most suppressed in 2004 were those of African Americans in Florida and in Ohio, and both, prevailing thought is, had African-American people voted and had their votes counted properly in both states, we would have had a much different history.
I think that is right, although also if you look at places like Palm Beach where they had the butterfly ballot,
right.
Another problem with this local administration, and there the person was a Democrat, but the person was frankly just not, it didn't think everything through and was basically experimenting on voters and treating them like lab rats. And we have a situation where the butterfly ballot resulted in, frankly, 6,000 votes being lost for Al Gore, and he lost by only about 537. And so I would agree with you that often African Americans are excluded, but it's not just African Americans. It's people of all backgrounds, and we all need to be concerned about this because we can all be excluded. For example, in Florida, there was an over-inclusive purge to try to strike felons from the rolls, and people who never committed a felony were struck. So even people who are great actors and good people who never do anything wrong are adversely affected by this this problematic and troubling election system that we have. So this is a problem that affects and impacts all of us.
Now, why haven't the Democrats, because I mean I don't want to be painted as a Democratic Party partisan, because I'm not, and I, like you, Spencer Overton, share criticisms of both parties for the way they function and want to, like you do, extend democracy and voting rights and have every vote counted. But over the last few years, since the Republicans have held political power so much, you have the Tom DeLay spectacle in Texas of redistricting, you have the 2004 election. Why haven't the Democrats, who can now play the victim card, which, you know, they wound up on the short end of things recently, why aren't they pressing a little more for accountability in electronic voting machines? Why aren't they calling for a national holiday where we would all have a day off and could take the day off and vote? That certainly would increase voting participation.
All right. Well, number one, I think, Peter, we can't rely on any partisans to protect voting rights. Number one, sometimes partisans benefit. If you look in Georgia, Democrats went out of their way to basically redistrict in a way that benefited themselves and harmed Republicans. So sometimes Democrats benefit from these techniques. So that's one issue. Another issue is that sometimes politicians don't see it in their best interest. They think that they'll whine if, you know, an Al Gore defends the voting rights of people in Florida. I know that in Virginia, Mark Warner is a Democrat, and he could have, through executive order, restored voting rights to 300,000 people who had served their time. So these are people who'd completed their sentence. Some of people who've never been to prison a day in their life, but Virginia has this rule that if you commit a felony, you're prevented from voting for life. Mark Warner didn't sign that order. I think he was just too afraid of being perceived as a liberal, and it would hurt his presidential chances in the future. Fortunately, in Iowa, the governor there did sign an order restoring voting rights to the people who had served their time. But like I said, in Virginia, the governor didn't, who was a Democrat. So I think that politicians have political motives. They're trying to position themselves, and we can't really rely on politicians to fix the problems. We really need to mobilize the citizens of all parties and really press politicians to change the existing system.
I actually agree with you 100%. I just wonder sometimes, and they probably figure, well, hey, it's working for them now. Wait till we get back in power. We'll do the same thing. But it would seem that an electoral holiday would be extraordinarily popular. I mean, it'd be very popular with me, I assume with you as well, if we said we're going to get a day off with pay. And it would increase the turnout of the working class and poor who have the worst voting statistics.
Well, Peter, I'd absolutely agree with you. In fact, I think that it would open up access to people. And I think the two big things we need to do in terms of changing things is I think we need to open up access. And I think we do that through an Election Day holiday, through Election Day registration as well, so that people can actually register on Election Day. We need to restore voting rights to former offenders who served their time in places like Virginia. We need translated election materials for people whose English is not as strong, citizens whose English is not as strong. We need federal funds so that we have enough machines and the lines aren't 4 hours. So on one hand, we need to open up access. Peter, I also think we need to stop manipulation by politicians by renewing the Voting Rights Act, also by auditing election offices and private vendors that supply voting machines and purge election lists. And we also need independent commissions rather than incumbents to draw lines, draw the redistricting lines, and then also to administer elections. So those two big things, opening up access to all citizens and then also stopping the manipulation by politicians, I think that those are the two big things we need to focus on.
I think that's an excellent summary. And fortunately, that leaves us with a few more minutes because there's so much in your book, Stealing Democracy. And you can go to stealingdemocracy.com to see more on Spencer Overton's book of the same name. And you mentioned the Voting Rights Act, which probably by the time this is aired, we're recording this, it will be renewed. But remind us when that came into being and why there was objection to it recently.
Well, you'll remember, Peter, that the Voting Rights Act was brought into effect in 1965, and it's really worked wonders in terms of integrating American politics. And if it does expire, we're in danger of losing hundreds, if not thousands, of Latino, Asian American, and African American officials. And it's still needed because there's still problems in Prairie View, Texas. In just 2004, for example, the district attorney there threatened to arrest students at a historically black college for voting, and also the county board there reduced the poll hours closest to the historically black college from 17 hours down to 6 hours. Now, fortunately, the Voting Rights Act stops this kind of racial manipulation by requiring that certain states show these election changes are not discriminatory, and if they can't show that, then the election changes aren't put on the books. So it's a perfect example of the fact that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, because it prevents costly lawsuits and prevents these discriminatory practices before they're even on the books. Also, translated election materials are an important part of the renewed Voting Rights Act for communities that are limited in their English skills. Now, there's been bipartisan support for the Voting Rights Act, but a narrow faction of obstructionists have stepped in the House. Fortunately, the House of Representatives passed it, and I think that we will see some success in terms of the renewal of the Voting Rights Act. And it's important that, you know, President Bush, I think he's been supportive of renewal of the Voting Rights Act, that he stand up, just like Lyndon Johnson stood up to Dixiecrats in the South, and say, hey, it's important that all Americans be able to cast a fair ballot and push this thing through.
And I suspect it will. Of the solutions that you put forth, they all were important ones, all good ones. But so much now has devolved down into the hands of the very people that would block this, the politicians themselves. And when we talk about democratic renewal, it really may take a mass movement of the nature. I'm sure it wouldn't get the same kind of resistance that the civil rights movement did, but we may have to just start meeting in churches and schools and communities and start saying, hey, let's reconfigure our democracy.
Peter, you're absolutely right, and politicians aren't going to take the lead on this. It's just not in their interest. It's really going to come down to average Americans, and like we said, it's important to vote, and you can register to vote at stealingdemocracy.com, but that's just the beginning. Well, you know, we need people to be involved and do things like work the polls and support watchdog groups like the League of Women Voters, the NAACP, Common Cause, election protection groups. We need people to preserve democracy in their own neighborhoods, but also to support larger reforms, whether it's lobbying the Michigan State Legislature on particular reforms and expressing citizen support for reforms, or passing by a ballot initiative, reforms like an independent commission to draw the districts, so that you're going to the people to make the decisions rather than going to the politicians to have to create electoral reform.
Well, thank you so much. The book is Stealing Democracy, The New Politics of Voter Suppression, is published by Norton. My guest has been Spencer Overton. Thanks so much for being on the Peter Werby Show.
Peter, thank you so much.
This is WRIF.com.
world.
Pretty cool, huh?
Bravo!
The latest news, pictures, Riff Cyber Crew text messaging, podcast, Riff blog, interviews, buy your favorite Riff rock from the digital music store, listen online, and so much more.
What a castle of hope this institution is for the people of the world.
Log on now at WRIF.com. Everything that rocks.